You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with the April 24th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. The understandable disgust of Big D Democrats with Donald Trump and their obsession with Russia's Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange that has roiled the nation's political water since the 2016 presidential election and produced the Mueller report appears to be far from over. To listen to politicians on both sides of the aisle in Washington, it's almost certainly going to be with us up to the 2020 election. And if the Democrats in their passion play their cards wrong, the nation and the world might be facing another 4 years of Donald Trump. At the same time, the efforts by the Trump administration, most visible through pronouncements by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to effectively destroy the Iranian economy in hopes of overthrowing that government through provoking an internal uprising and provide an excuse for intervening militarily, have been escalating. Yet they haven't drawn anything like the attention from the media, the political class, or the public that greeted the Mueller report, despite being, I will argue, unquestionably more important. Both of these subjects are what I hope to be discussing with investigative reporter journalist Gareth Porter, 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. One of the things that I have found most disturbing in the Mueller report and with the Big D Democrats, who have fetishized it, is their obvious belief that it would have been better if Democratic voters had never learned how the Democratic Party hierarchy had sabotaged the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders on Hillary Clinton's behalf. It was not only as a result of WikiLeaks' release of the emails of the Democratic National Committee and later of Clinton campaign chair John Podesta that their unconscionable and intentional interference in the 2016 Democratic primaries came to light, which, as the Washington Post Aaron Blake wrote at the time, quote, suggests the committee was actively trying to undermine Sanders' presidential campaign and belie the National Party's commitment to state neutrality. The only penalty for the main culprit, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a close Clinton confidant, was that she had to step down from her post as DNC chair while retaining her place in Clinton's entourage and a prominent figure in Democrat Party politics. Already reported the Washington Post, how could they know at the time? The Clinton campaign and several cybersecurity experts said the leak was a political ploy carried out by the Russian government to aid in the election of Trump, end quote. But no one could deny the emails and the documents they contained were not authentic. I read one that I had earlier missed just this past Monday, which I'm going to share with you, in an article entitled Elevating Trump by Rich Moser and Counterpunch, published October 11th, 2016, a month before the election, which cited a link to an email message to the staff on John Podesta's computer dated April 23, 2015, containing an agenda for a meeting of the Democratic National Committee the following day, which is 4 years ago today. That was before, mark you, before Trump had formally announced his candidacy, but the meeting agenda was focused on pushing for the Republicans to nominate the most far-right candidate possible. The three leading choices were Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and Ben Carson. The new evidence provided by WikiLeaks Podesta's files, wrote Richard Moser on Counterpunch back 2015, makes a convincing case that the Clinton team wanted extreme Republicans as the best possible opponents. The proof of that was obvious from the following quotes in that memo describing the Clinton campaign strategy, quote, force all Republican candidates to lock themselves into extreme conservative positions that will hurt them in a general election. The variety of candidates is a positive here, and many of the lesser-known can serve as a cudgel to move the more established candidates further to the right. In this scenario, it goes on, we don't want to marginalize the candidates, but make them more Pied Piper candidates who actually represent the mainstream Republican Party. Pied Piper candidates include, but aren't limited to, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, Ben Carson. We need to be elevating the Pied Piper candidates, said the email from, quote, Mastor at HillaryClinton.com, so that they are leaders of the pack and tell the press to take them seriously, end quote. You'll recall, as does Moser and Counterpunch, that for months the mass media was quite comfortable broadcasting Trump's bigotry. I always wondered, he wrote, why media giants so deeply committed to the Clinton machine, big donors to the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton campaign alike, lavish so much attention and so many resources on Trump. They are driven by the same desire to maximize profit as other corporations, true, he notes, but it still seems like there were other stories that could sell soap. The New York Times has estimated that $2 billion worth of free media coverage was given to Trump. Half that would be astounding, Moser wrote. Disasters like the election of 2016 have an overabundance of causes, he concedes, but the Democrats' desire to elevate Trump was part of the potion. And the media followed direction with gusto, end quote. That's from Elevating Trump by Rich Moser and Counterpunch from October 11, 2015, and you can find the entire article online. By an extraordinary coincidence, around the very time that meeting took place, the Washington Post reported that Bill Clinton was urging his golfing buddy, Donald Trump, to become more active in Republican Party politics. Something to think about, no? Well, for doing that, for providing the WikiLeaks with emails with cables from the Iraq War, Manning has done far more prison time than all those who perpetrated that unforgivable disaster combined, and she still is in prison for refusing to testify against Assange at a grand jury lynching in Virginia. Meanwhile, Assange sits in solitary confinement in a maximum security London prison, awaiting likely extradition to the U.S. As to why the alleged cooperation with Russian hackers was not part of the government's charges against Assange, we have to turn to someone from the right, Andrew McCarthy, an editor at the National Review. Why hasn't Assange been indicted for criminal collusion with the Kremlin, he asked in the April 13th issue under the title, Why Isn't Assange Charged with Collusion with Russia? The same hacking conspiracy for which Mueller indicted the Russian operatives with whom Mueller says Assange cooperated. The same conspiracy for which the President of the United States, though not guilty, was under the FBI's microscope for nearly 3 years. Well, the most striking thing about the Assange indictment that the Justice Department did file, McCarthy notes, is how thin it is and how tenuous. Leaping years backward, ignoring collusion with Russia, quote-unquote, prosecutors allege a single cyber theft count, a conspiracy between Assange and then Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, to steal U.S. defense secrets, end quote. This lone charge, he asserts, is punishable by as little as no jail time and a maximum sentence of just 5 years imprisonment, considerably less than the 7 years Assange spent holed up in Ecuador's London embassy to avoid prosecution. After a lengthy breaking down of the Mueller report and the claims of Russian hacking, which he does not contest, he surmises that if the Justice Department had indicted Assange for collusion, Mueller's Russian hacking indictment would no longer stand unchallenged. Assange, he says, would deny that Russia is behind the hacking, and prosecutors would have to try to prove it using hard, admissible courtroom proof, not top-secret sources who cannot be called as witnesses without blowing their cover, or other information that might be reliable enough to support an intelligence finding but would be inadmissible under courtroom due process standards. If the prosecutors, he writes, were unable to establish Russia's guilt to a jury's satisfaction, it would be a tremendous propaganda victory for the Kremlin, even if, as I believe, Russia is actually guilty. That's McCarthy, not me. He goes on, this is part of why it was a mistake to indict the Russian intelligence officers. An indictment is never an authoritative statement. It's just an allegation. It proves nothing. Because they don't have to surrender their officials for an American trial, an indictment is a pointless gesture. But now, writes McCarthy, having with great fanfare filed charges against Russia that implicate Assange, the government shrinks from lodging these same charges against Assange, who, unlike the indicted Russian officials, writes McCarthy, may be in a position to put the government to its burden of proof. This just makes Mueller's indictment of Russia look more like a publicity stunt than a serious allegation. So writes McCarthy, if the government is afraid to try the allegations against Russia in court, people will naturally suspect the allegations are hype. end quote. National Review's Andrew McCarthy. And that's something I and former guests of mine have assumed from the beginning. Now, shifting to Iran, following on the heels of declaring the Iran Revolutionary Guards to be a terrorist organization, despite opposition from the Pentagon and the CIA, because of the danger in which it would place U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, which I reported on my last program, Secretary of State and former Tea Party stalwart Mike Pompeo has just repeated Washington's demand to the nations of the world that the United States will not allow them to buy Iranian oil, the lifeblood of that country's economy, and that the eight countries that have been given a waiver by the U.S. to continue purchasing Iran's oil to meet their respective countries' energy needs will no longer be allowed to do so after May 2nd, when the waiver expires. The eight countries in Imperial Washington insist must bow to its will or face U.S. sanctions are China and India, two of the world's largest economies, plus Turkey, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Italy, and Greece. The smaller countries reportedly have been slowly shifting to other sources, but that is not feasible for China or India, nor likely Turkey. While the Indian government has remained silent up to now what it will do, and experts there are saying it will create an economic crisis that the country can ill afford, China has told Washington that it is not about to abide by U.S. dictates. China consistently opposes U.S. unilateral sanctions, said Zhang Shuang, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman. The Chinese government, he says, is committed to protecting the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese enterprises, end quote. There is concern in global economic circles about what effect the U.S. crackdown will have on the price of gasoline, which is expected to go up dramatically, as you see it already has. But the more serious consequences are facing the government of Iran and its population, who are being economically squeezed by the Trump administration, which, on this issue, as on all others in the region, is following not that of corporate America, which would like to do business with Iran, but of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Trump's most prominent financial backer, Israeli firster mega-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who is responsible for the appointment by Trump of neocon fanatic John Bolton as National Security Advisor and Pompeo to replace H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson, whose support for Israel was less than 100%. And do not for a moment think that Trump's turning over American Middle East policy to Netanyahu is not appreciated. Thanks to his very public support for the Israeli prime minister in the recent election, and where polls there are shown to be more popular than Netanyahu, Trump's recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Syrian Golan Heights on the eve of the election will result in a new town being named after him on the Golan Heights, which would be called Kiryat Trump. That's what Netanyahu announced yesterday. I am waiting for someone in Washington, on or in the media, to call for a special counsel to investigate a president who has turned over his foreign policy to the head of a foreign power and done so in a very public way. But given the inordinate power of Israel and its friends over virtually everything that moves in Washington, we know that's not about to happen. Even if the undeclared economic war in Iran, on Israel's behalf, turns into a shooting war that will be far more devastating for the region and the planet than what the U.S. did, arguably on Israel's behalf, in Iraq. There is a certain point we can expect that Iran will argue that it can no longer accept being squeezed to death by what it calls the Great Satan on behalf of what it labels Israel, the Little Satan. And there are already stories appearing on the Internet asserting that the U.S. will create a false flag incident like the fabricated Gulf of Tonkin attack, which was used to justify Lyndon Johnson's massive escalation of the Vietnam War. Such a false flag attack to be blamed on Iran was actually suggested in a talk several years ago by Patrick Clausen of the APAC-spawned pro-Israel Washington think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which you can find online and which I played for you on a previous program. That we may be getting close to a shooting war with Iran was more than hinted at when, according to the Times of Israel, an Iranian naval commander threatened on Monday to close the strategic Strait of Hormuz, which, located at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, is crucial to global energy supplies, with about a third of all oil traded at sea passing through it. Iran regularly holds maneuvers in the strait, which at its narrowest point is 21 miles wide, in the waters between Iran and Oman. If we are banned from using it, we will close it. General Ali Reza Thangsiri, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Navy, was quoted as saying by the semi-official Iranian Tasnim news agency. Well, such threats have been made before, and skirmishes have occurred between the U.S. and Iran in the Straits, but never has there been an administration so likely to turn one into a full-scale war. Finally, a brief comment on Israel's election of April 9th from Robert Fisk, the Beirut-based dean of Middle East correspondence. So now, writes Fisk, so now I guess we've all run out of excuses. Bibi Netanyahu's Israel will not be a new and more right-wing Israel. It's been that for a long time. It's the propaganda that's going to fall to bits. The only democracy in the Middle East? Give me a break, writes Fisk. I think Israel now looks much more like its Arab neighbors. It dominates its own Arab minority, and its new prime minister has promised to annex much of the territory legally belonging to their fellow Palestinian Arabs, the very colonies built on lands which have already been stolen from the majority Jewish population in Israel. It bombards and threatens its neighbors, jails Palestinian political prisoners on spurious grounds, and rules well over 2 million Arab Palestinians with killer police squads, extrajudicial executions, torture, and paid spies. Now that the Israelis voted Netanyahu and his outrageous party allies back into power, writes Fisk, they too have sacrificed their souls to Bibi. Not maybe their bloody rights, because even Bibi knows that long and painful wars are not what Israelis have voted for. Short and painless ones for Israel are okay. It's the Arabs who must bear the pain. End quote. Well, that's an excerpt from Robert Fisk's commentary on the Israeli elections you could find on the Independent news site, entitled No More Excuses, Israeli Voters Have Chosen a Country That Will Mirror the Brutal Regimes of Its Arab Neighbors. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
Journalist Ali Abu Nima is the co-founder and executive director of the widely acclaimed Electronic Intifada, a non-profit, independent online publication focusing on Palestine. He has been an active part of the movement for justice in Palestine for 2 decades and was the recipient of a 2013 Lannan Cultural Freedom Fellowship. A graduate of Princeton University and the University of Chicago, Ali is a frequent speaker on the Middle East, contributing regularly to numerous publications. He is also the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, and The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And he will be signing both books in the Ideas Fair room during the morning break, immediately following our question and answer session. The Electronic Intifada has been at the forefront in fighting censorship by obtaining, releasing, and contextualizing The Lobby, the suppressed Al Jazeera documentary exposing the strategies and activities of the Israel lobby in this country. Today he will be addressing the question, what does a censored undercover news investigation reveal about the Israel lobby in America? So please join me in welcoming Ali Abu Nima.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone, and thank you to the organizers, to the Institute, and to the Washington Report for inviting me back here for the second year in a row, and it's an honor and a pleasure to see so many people here this morning. And some of you were in the room last year when I stood here to talk about this documentary, and at that time, nobody had seen it, and Grant asked me, he said, do you think we'll ever see it? And I don't remember exactly what I said, but I think I said, we will see it. or I didn't know. And what happened was in back in March last year, our publication, the Electronic Intifada, was the first to publish reports of the contents of the documentary. In August, we were the first to publish excerpts, video excerpts from the film. And in November, we, along with Al-Akhbar in Beirut and Orion 21 in France, actually published the entire film. Now, for those of you who don't know anything about this film, and there may be some people, first let me give credit to the team at Al Jazeera Investigations, led by Clayton Swisher and Phil Reese and their colleagues, and of course the undercover reporter known as Tony, who did a really fantastic historic piece of journalism, a four-part documentary going undercover in the Israel lobby, in the Israel project, revealing candid conversations by top Israel lobbyists who did not know that they were being recorded. But unfortunately, this fantastic piece of journalism was suppressed, and I'll say more about that in a moment. But let me just ask, how many of the people in this room have actually watched the documentary or any part of it? And I'm going to say that that's maybe about 25 to 30%, which is pretty good. But really, I'd like to encourage everyone to watch it. And it's available online free at the Electronic Intifada and other sites. And already hundreds of thousands of people, if not maybe in the low millions, have seen it if you were to add up all the different copies that are out there. So what does this film reveal? Well, first, a little bit of background. The film was made by Al Jazeera in 2016 and was completed in 2017. But as I mentioned, it was censored after Qatar, the Gulf state that funds Al Jazeera, came under intense pressure from the Israel lobby. Now, this is remarkable because it's a film about the power of the Israel lobby, and this same lobby succeeded in getting Qatar to suppress this film, all the while denying that the Israel lobby has any power or influence. Late last year, the Director General of Al Jazeera claimed at a conference in the U.S. that the reason the film had not been shown was due to outstanding legal issues. This was flatly contradicted by his own journalists, and we know that, in fact, the film had been completed and it had passed through all of the usual and rigorous legal and standards review that Al Jazeera does. And we know how rigorous that is because in January of 2017, Al Jazeera did actually broadcast a similar film focused on the Israel lobby in the UK. That film revealed that a spy at the Israeli embassy called Shai Masat was working secretly, in his words, to take down a British government minister who was deemed too critical of Israel, and to secretly set up a pro-Israel organization within the opposition Labour Party. This was being run out of the Israeli embassy. When this was revealed, the British expelled Shai Masat, but the British government very quickly swept all this under the carpet. But significantly, after the film was broadcast, and you can watch that film on the Al Jazeera website because they did actually broadcast it. After the film was broadcast, Israel lobby groups and individuals in the UK filed a raft of complaints with Ofcom, the British broadcast regulator. We don't really have an equivalent in the US where you can complain about Fox or CNN or MSNBC or Rachel Maddow for mad conspiracies claiming Russia is going to cut off the heating of Americans in the depth of winter. There's no one to complain to for that. But in the UK, they have a powerful broadcast regulator that can actually take away your license. And Ofcom did an 8-month investigation and threw out every single complaint against the documentary. There was no bias, there was no misrepresentation, there was no unfairness in it. And the US film was made to exactly the same standards by exactly the same journalists. This film, which I again encourage you all to watch, exposes the efforts of Israel and its lobbyists to spy on, smear, and intimidate U.S. citizens who support Palestinian human rights, especially the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. It shows that Israel is running a covert and semi-covert black ops from a government agency called the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which is staffed by many people from Israel's intelligence agencies, and that this effort is being done in collusion with an extensive network of U.S.-based organizations who are not registered under FARA as agents of a foreign power, but based on what is in the documentary, they clearly should be. These organizations include the Israel on Campus Coalition, the Israel Project, and the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. It's more like the Foundation for Defense of Apartheid, Occupation, Sniper Murder, and so on. It also showed how the Israeli embassy in Washington itself was running some of these operations. For example, a woman called Julia Rifkind, who at that time was an Israeli embassy employee, but previously was an APAC campus activist in California, described her typical daily work as, quote, mainly gathering intel, reporting back to Israel to report to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. And she discusses how the Israeli government is, quote, giving our support to various front groups, in quote, that behind-the-scenes way. She also talks about using fake Facebook profiles to monitor campus and pro-Palestine groups. And again, these efforts are run in direct coordination with the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, whose director general is a woman called Sima Vaknin-Gil, who was herself a former military intelligence officer. And she talks about how her operation, run through the ministry, has mapped the universe of Palestinian rights activism globally, quote, not just the United States, not just campuses, but campuses and intersectionality and labor unions and churches. And she says that this data is used for, quote, offense activity against Palestine activists. The film also shows Jacob Baim, executive director of the Israel on Campus Coalition, describing how his organization runs a multi-million dollar effort. He doesn't say exactly where those millions come from, but he talks about millions of dollars using corporate-level, enterprise-grade social media intelligence software, those are his words, to gather lists of Palestine-related student events on campus, quote, generally within about 30 seconds or less of them being posted online, and how this information is then filtered to this network of organizations that are working to sabotage these groups and that this effort is coordinated with the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Jacob Boehm describes how the Israel on Campus Coalition, as part of this Israel-run or Israel-coordinated strategy, uses anonymous websites to target activists. Quote, with the anti-Israel people, what's most effective, what we've found at least in the last year, is you do the opposition research, put up some anonymous website, and then put up targeted ads on Facebook. He talks about Canary Mission as a good example and adds, it's psychological warfare. One of the cases in the film that's profiled is Professor Bill Mullen at Purdue University in Indiana, who found himself the target of just such an anonymous smear campaign where websites went up featuring totally false accusations of sexual harassment and anti-Semitism against him, even to the point where these websites mentioned his young daughter and his wife. So you can imagine the psychological effect on someone of seeing websites with that kind of false allegation. Other websites targeting student leaders in Indiana included one which claimed that a young woman was a terrorist, and another which claimed that a young Muslim woman activist was engaging in late-night drinking and sex and other activities which were calculated to try to shame her and to, to bring her into disrepute with her family and her community. The film named convicted tax evader Adam Milstein, who is also the chair of a lobby group called the Israeli American Council, which is positioning itself to the right of AIPAC, if you can believe such a thing, as being the mastermind and key funder of Canary Mission, an anonymous website that, again, targets students and professors. I should mention that Jacob Boehm of the Israel on Campus Coalition described this strategy to smear and target and intimidate people as inspired by General Stanley McChrystal's counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan, for all the success that has had. Since the U.S. is, of course, now in direct negotiations with the Taliban 18-odd years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. Nonetheless, it shows the mindset that Israel and its proxies in the United States are waging a war on American citizens, including teenagers on college campuses who are exercising their constitutional rights to speak up about an issue they care about deeply. We have it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Sima Vaknin-Gill, the Director General of the Foreign Ministry, states very explicitly, we have FDD, that's the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. We have FDD, we have others working on projects including data gathering, information analysis, working on activist organizations, money trail. This is something that only a country with its resources can do the best. So she is states on camera in the film that these groups are working with the Israeli government to carry out this operation. But when we checked on the U.S. government's Foreign Agents Registration Act website, we did not find the Foundation for Defense of Democracies or any of its principals registered as agents of the Israeli government. One of the revelations in the film that I found particularly amusing, let's say, is Israel's effort, or rather the efforts of the Israel Project. The Israel Project is a lobby group based here in Washington. It's run by a former Clinton administration official, Josh Block, who also worked for AIPAC previously. And it also works closely with the Israeli government. And the Israel Project, actually the undercover reporter, Tony, as he's known in the film, actually got a job, an internship at the Israel Project, which is pretty amazing. But the Israel Project, the film reveals, was running a major effort, a major covert influence campaign on Facebook. And this is really remarkable. What they did is set up pages or communities on Facebook. Some of them have hundreds of thousands, half a million or more followers. And one of them, I don't know if we have the ability to project from the internet, but I should have thought of this. But one of them puts up really cute pictures of kittens and donuts. Here's one of the actual Israel Project donuts. This is a black and white image, but it's really pink. It actually looks toxic. It looks like it would kill you if you ate it, because no food is naturally that shade of hot pink. But it actually describes itself as on the about section of the Facebook community. It's called Cup of Jane, and it describes itself as sugar and spice and everything nice. What it tries to do is to establish progressive credibility by posting not just pictures of kittens and donuts, but also photos and quotations from such black female icons as Maya Angelou and Ida B. Wells. There are also posts about the groundbreaking environmentalist Rachel Carson, and even about Emma Gonzalez, who, along with her classmates, launched a national campaign for gun legislation after surviving the Parkland school massacre in Florida. But woven into this stream of progressive-flavored fluff are attacks on actual progressive movements and pro-Israel propaganda. For example, a posting in October 2016 attempted to portray Israeli militarism as cute and empowering. They actually posted a photo of an Israeli F-16 fighter jet painted pink. Pink is a very important color to the Israel Project. And it says, and then the post said, "The Israeli Air Force has painted fighters in pink in aid of Breast Cancer Awareness Month." How cool is that? And then it adds, "This is fierce. Women, by the way, need an air force all their own. So feminist." Of course, at the same time that this is going on, dozens of women in Gaza documented to have died due to Israel's siege, denying them potentially life-saving treatment, and dozens of cancer patients, I should say, many of them women, documented by the World Health Organization to have died because Israel would not allow them out of the Gaza ghetto to obtain life-saving treatment. But this is the propaganda that Cup of Jane is pushing. And it's very clear why. Or the Israel Project is pushing, and it's very clear why. It's because Israel's brand is toxic, and you can't sell it directly, especially to young people. And so you have to try to mix it in with hip, cool stuff that looks innocuous or even progressive. And the film shows one of the staffers at the Israel Project explaining The logic behind this, Jordan Schachtel, he says, we're putting together a lot of pro-Israel media through various social media channels that aren't the Israel Project's channels. So we have a lot of side projects that we are trying to influence the public debate with. That's why it's a secretive thing, because we don't want people to know that the side projects are associated with the Israel Project. And in fact, this network of pages run by the Israel Project are not labeled as being run by the Israel Project, or they just say a project of TIP, T-I-P. Nobody who doesn't know what the Israel Project is would have any idea what TIP is. So it was a covert effort. Now, when we asked Facebook to comment on this and to look into it, the media office, said, okay, we'll have a look. And they got back to us and they said, we asked specifically, does any of this violate your terms of service? Remember, this is at the same time as Facebook is taking down pages of legitimate news organizations and legitimate organizations based on the claim that they're somehow agents of Russian influence. Completely bogus stuff. And Facebook has partnered with the Israeli government to shut down Palestinian media pages. Facebook partnered with the Atlantic Council, the NATO think tank here in Washington, funded by the U.S. government, by the European Union, by the United Arab Emirates, by Saudi Arabia, partnered with them to supposedly identify pages that should be taken down. And they took down lots of pages that were perfectly legitimate, including, as I mentioned, pages of journalists and media organizations. But Facebook's reply to us about this extensive, covert Israeli influence campaign on their platform, or pro-Israel influence campaign on their platform, was this violates none of our rules. And those pages are still operating. So there's a lot more in this film in reference to the Benjamins, let's say. It reveals, again, some of this is known, but it's different to actually see people talking about how it's done. Fundraisers for political candidates where hundreds of thousands of dollars can be raised in a single night without anything being put on paper. You have one of the people involved in this fundraising saying, we don't even send out invitations. There's nothing, but these fundraisers, people just hand over their credit cards and the organizer runs it up for the maximum, $2,700 or whatever it is. And in a single night, they can raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for a political candidate who agrees to toe the Israel lobby's line. And what's significant in the film, I'm not an expert on campaign finance law, but the film indicates that these practices are, if not outright illegal, certainly come very close to skirting the campaign finance laws. And we need to have a conversation about that because it is very much about the Benjamins. Let me conclude with a couple of comments about the Israel lobby in general. I again commend this film to you, and I would like to see everyone watch it. It's great viewing. And not just watching it, but sharing it, telling people about it. How can you find it? Just go on Google and search, watch the film The Israel Lobby Didn't Want You to See. And it will come up because that's the headline that we ran it under. Watch the film The Israel Lobby Didn't Want You to See. And you can see it. I think the bigger picture is that, you know, you're going to hear, we heard this morning from the extremely informative learned presentation of Professor Hickson, that this lobby is very powerful. And you're going to hear that again throughout the day, and it is very powerful. But there is a subtle message that we should also not ignore, which is that this lobby is losing its power. Because the Israel lobby, its power operates best in the dark. And already what we're having, even with the completely unfounded attacks on Representative Ilhan Omar, is something the Israel lobby never wants, which is a public discussion about it. In the film, Jonathan Shanzer, the vice president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, makes an admission. He says, personally, I think that anti-Semitism as a smear is not what it used to be. I completely share Professor Hickson's statement that we must stand against anti-Semitism as any other form of racism. Anti-Jewish bigotry of any kind has no place in a movement for Palestinian human rights. That's a message that we as advocates for Palestinian liberation must always be in the forefront of saying. But of course, there is a cynical campaign to weaponize false accusations of anti-Semitism to smear and silence people. And this has been done with, sadly, a great deal of success in the UK, where for the past 3 or 4 years, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn has been the target of bogus claims that the party under his leadership is facing endemic institutional anti-Semitism. It's a lie. It's an outright lie. There have been a very few number of marginal cases which have rightly been condemned, but there's no evidence that the party is institutionally anti-Semitic. But the warning I want to give here is that this template is now being imported from the UK directly to the US. And to the Democratic Party. And again, it's not a sign necessarily of the strength of this lobby, but a sign of its weakness, in the sense that if the Democratic Party was all solidly pro-Israel, as perhaps it used to be, you wouldn't need to smear people as anti-Semites. It's because of the growing support for Palestinian rights, the growing disgust that the party establishment's complicity with Israel, Nancy Pelosi, led the smears against Ilhan Omar, and Nancy Pelosi will be at AIPAC in the coming days, and proudly so. It's because the base is rejecting this message from the leadership that we must all march in lockstep with Israel that this debate is happening. And so I end with the words of Eric Gallagher, one of the Israel Project officials featured in the film, who himself used to work for AIPAC. And he says, "The foundation that AIPAC sat on is rotting. There used to be actual widespread public support for Israel in the United States. So I don't think that AIPAC is going to remain as influential as it is." That's a very optimistic note for us to end on, coming straight from a former AIPAC official. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ali. We have some questions here that I'll read to you. The first one is, and I have a corollary to it, so I'm going to indulge myself with that. Will the Lobby US be available on DVD, which I know you may not be able to control, but I'm also thinking, will it be shown on campuses where so many students are being attacked by the Canary Mission and are so scared about their future because of that? I mean, doesn't that seem like a great combination?
That is a great question. Well, the first thing to say is we obtained a leaked copy of this film. Several people asked me, you're going to explain how you got it, and I hate to disappoint you, but no, I'm not going to explain how we got it. The important thing is we did get it and we released it. But we don't have any copyright over it. And in fact, in releasing this film, arguably we took a risk because we didn't know what the reaction of Al Jazeera would be because this is their film. Of course, I believe that there was a strong public interest in releasing this film and a strong journalistic defense in doing so. But I can't tell you to show it or not show it. We've made it available, and people are free to do as they wish with it. If they want to burn it on DVDs or show it on college campuses, I think it needs to be seen. But that's not something that we have the permission to say you can do it or don't do it. But I do believe that there is a public interest in seeing this film and in sharing this film. The only reaction we've seen from Al Jazeera is they issued a statement saying, oh, we're very disappointed that it's come out. But we've seen no other action from them so far.
Another question is, can you expand on the relationship of collusion between the mainstream press and the lobby? And I don't know if it was in the Al Jazeera video, but it's my impression that the Israel Project works with porn bureaus of newspapers in Israel.
Yes, that is something that the film shows, how the Israel Project shapes coverage. And again, the main media organizations, whether it's the AP or CNN or others, they have their bureaus in Tel Aviv. They don't have bureaus in Gaza or even the West Bank for the most part. And so they rely very much on Israeli organizations or even the Israeli government to provide them access. And in the film, the Israel Project claims that it got the AP to actually change headlines to be more, in accord with its message. And it also profiles a CNN report on supposed terror tunnels from Gaza that the Israel Project claimed complete credit for shaping. And you actually see the CNN report and how it's just putting out completely bogus Israel lobby talking points and Israeli propaganda. You know, the so-called terror tunnels from Gaza, they presented this as if Palestinians are digging tunnels from Gaza to come up in Israeli kindergartens and Israeli bedrooms. And this is a total lie. There is no case ever where Palestinians have used a tunnel to do anything from Gaza other than to attack legitimate military targets. And that was stated explicitly in the UN's Independent Commission of Inquiry report on the 2014 Gaza War. But you wouldn't know that from watching CNN. So that's an example of the collusion that's featured in the film.
Okay, another question is, how do you explain how we have missed the potential political gain brought by these documentaries? How the tide has been overturned? Where and when did we fail, both in the UK and the US?
You know, I don't know what more we could do. I think we're in an atmosphere where establishment media, establishment politicians don't want to talk about this, and we know why. You look at what happened to Ilhan Omar, the weight of the lobby is such that people are afraid. People are afraid to do it. More and more people are talking, and that's a good thing. I think things are changing, as I mentioned. But take just the, I mentioned this before, but to me it's really striking that, leave aside the explosive content of this film, just the mere fact that this film was suppressed under pressure from the same lobby on the government of Qatar. That by itself is a major story. Imagine if this film had been about supposed Russian interference and the Russian government had put pressure on a major international network to suppress the documentary. Rachel Maddow would be shouting from the rooftops. CNN, Jake Tapper would be shouting from the rooftops. It would be front page news on the New York Times and the Washington Post. Instead, total silence. And another part of the story that's incredible, that's not in the film, but is very much in the reporting the Electronic Intifada did around it, is that Israel lobby effort and Qatar's effort to court the Israel lobby, which included, hiring a lobbyist here in Washington at $50,000 a month, and that lobbyist then bringing a parade of some of the most extreme right pro-Israel figures from the U.S. to Qatar, some of them meeting with the emir, for example, Alan Dershowitz, and Morton Klein, the head of the Zionist Organization of America. And Qatar even gave donations of hundreds of thousands of dollars to Zionist organizations, including the Zionist Organization of America. It's incredible. No one is talking about that. But it's nobody can deny it because it's all in the official disclosure documents that the lobbying firm had to do. Of how much money, where the money came from and who it went to. It came from Qatar and it went to the Zionist Organization of America. Those relationships have to be investigated. The only thing I'll say is, we, the Electronic Intifada, a little publication, we have a staff of 8, we were able to do this because we're independent. Because we're funded by our readers, that's not a pitch, but feel free to donate. electronicintifada.net. There's a button there, donate now. But that's critical. That's critical. Is the fact that we're independent. We do not fear the pressure of the lobby. No one is going to fire us for doing this job because this is our job and it's what people support us to do.
Another question of you is any pro-Israel group registered as a foreign agent, to your knowledge?
I'm not the expert on that. I think Grant Smith is the expert on that. I don't know if he can.
I think there have been attempts to register AIPAC in its early days.
AIPAC is definitely not registered. I don't think any of the group. I know we checked the Foundation for Defense of Democracies is not registered. The Israel on Campus Coalition is not registered. We checked when we were doing the reporting, and we could not find any evidence that those groups were registered. I think there is at least one we found that had registered, but its name escapes me now. It is a relatively small player, but that's a question perhaps Grant can answer when he's back up here.
So a final question about the film. Now that the documentary is out, was there anything in it concerning or invoking foreign agency and dual loyalty? And if not, was that deliberate, do you think?
The film does not use the term dual loyalty, and that's sort of a trigger term that I don't like to use because I think I have heard people use it in a way that suggests that to me suggests kind of a racist or anti-Semitic tone. So I don't like to use that term, dual loyalty, in that sense. The film has nothing anti-Semitic in it. It is strict reporting. It doesn't accuse people of dual loyalty. It simply reports what they're doing. And nobody has disputed the reporting. Of course, Morton Klein and the Zionist Organization of America claimed that the film was anti-Semitic. But, we can be descriptive and accurate that these groups profiled in the film, are working with the Israeli government to implement the Israeli government's agenda of shutting down support for Palestinian rights by spying on, smearing, and sabotaging American citizens. And to me, there's no dual loyalty there. It seems to me that their primary or only loyalty is to the agenda of Israel. It's also important to state and note that, and to be very clear about this, that there is no, the Israel lobby, this film focuses on several organizations because those are the ones the journalists were able to get into. But the Israel lobby is much bigger than the organizations that are profiled in that film. And, of course, the largest base of the Israel lobby in the United States, and increasingly so, is not Jewish Americans. It is the Christian Zionist component. That is the mass base of the Israel lobby today in the United States. And, of course, we know that there is a very disturbing relationship there in the sense that a large part of that pro-Israel Christian evangelical base, that support for Israel is based on anti-Semitic theology.
Okay, well, I think we're out of time.
I still have 3 minutes.
Okay.
I mean, only if you want to take another question. No, only if there's another question. If there is one, we'll take it.
I have a question about anti-Semitism.
Okay.
Given the trajectory of the lobby's development over the years and the misuse and abuse of anti-Semitism, what do you see as the greatest fear of real anti-Semitism in America going forward?
That's a great question. And there is real anti-Semitism in America, and there is real anti-Semitism in Europe, and this anti-Semitism is coming from the right. It's coming from white nationalists. It's coming from neo-Nazis. It's coming from the type of ideology that drove the shooter in the Quebec City mosque and in Christchurch Mosque. It's coming from the same ideology that is driving xenophobia and Islamophobia in Europe. Notably, most of the governments that condemned the Christchurch shooting didn't mention Islamophobia because they would be naming themselves. Because so much of the Islamophobia that was in the New Zealand Shooters Manifesto could have been talking points from practically any major political party in the West today. I'm sorry to say it. I think Professor Hickson also underlined that in his comments. The total normalization of references to Islamic extremism and tarring, 2 billion people in the world as linked to terrorism. Whereas this real rise and real disturbing trend of lethal anti-Semitism is clearly visible, its ally is Israel. Let's be clear about that. Who is allied with the anti-Semitic governments of Hungary, of Poland, of anti-Semitic racist Islamophobic movements like the Freedom Party in Austria that is half of the coalition government there, the Alternative for Deutschland Party? You find that all of these far-right parties have close ties to Israel, and particularly to Benjamin Netanyahu. You'll remember, after Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, praised Miklos Horthy, the wartime collaborationist leader who sent 500,000 Hungarian Jews to their deaths in Hitler's camps, after the Israeli Foreign Ministry condemned the Hungarian Prime Minister for praising Horthy, Netanyahu personally overruled the Foreign Ministry and ordered them to withdraw that statement. Because Viktor Orban and the anti-Semitic government of Hungary are his friends. And that's the service Israel provides in the world today. It's a whitewashing and laundry service for anti-Semites and racists of all kinds. As if you're the Freedom Party in Austria and founded by former Nazis, if you come to Israel and go light a candle at Yad Vashem and say, how much you love Israel, then the Israeli Prime Minister is prepared to give you a certificate of good conduct. So Israel is a force today of anti-Semitism, white supremacy, and extremism that is destabilizing the world. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week, you're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In a May 17th article, news anchor Dan Rather finally came clean about the media manipulation surrounding the Bush administration's war on the world. Unfortunately, his confession came not in the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post, where it might be seen by many Americans. The article, titled "U.S. Media Cowed by Patriotic Fever," says CBS star, was written by Matthew Engel for the British newspaper The Guardian and based on an interview on British television. Engel wrote, "Dan Rather, the star news anchor for the U.S. television network CBS, said last night that, quote, patriotism run amok, unquote, was in danger of trampling the freedom of American journalists to ask tough questions. And he admitted that he had shrunk from taking on the Bush administration over the war on terrorism. In the weeks after September 11th, Rather wore a Stars and Stripes pin in his lapel during his evening news show in an apparent display of total solidarity with the American cause. However, in an interview with BBC's Newsnight, he graphically described the pressures to conform that built up after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Quote, it's an obscene comparison. You know, I'm not sure I like it. But you know, there was a time in South Africa that people would put flaming tires around people's necks if they dissented. And in some ways, the fear is that you will be necklaced here. You will have a flaming tire of lack of patriotism around your neck, he said. Now it is that fear that keeps journalists from asking the toughest of the tough questions. Rather did not exempt himself from the criticism and said the problem was self-censorship. Quote, it starts with a feeling of patriotism within oneself. It carries through with a certain knowledge that the country as a whole, and for all the right reasons, felt and continues to feel this surge of patriotism within themselves. And one finds oneself saying, I know the right question, but you know what? This is not exactly the right time to ask it. Such a confession is astonishing, bearing in mind its source. Rather is almost as famous in the U.S. as the president, though he is more secure in his tenure, far better paid, and probably more pampered. Rather, 70 has held what used to be regarded as the top job in American journalism for two decades, since he was chosen to succeed the revered and avuncular Walter Cronkite as CBS News anchorman. Traditionally, CBS was the country's number one news channel, but has lost its status and ratings after years of budget cutbacks. The White House was to blame for its failure to provide adequate information about the war, Rather said. Quote, "There has never been an American war, small or large, in which access has been so limited as this one. Limiting access, limiting information to cover the backsides of those who are in charge of the war is extremely dangerous and cannot and should not be accepted. And I am sorry to say that, up to and including the moment of this interview, that overwhelmingly it has been accepted by the American people. And the current administration revels in that, they relish that, and they take refuge in that," close quote. He said his view of patriotism differed from that of the administration. Quote, "It's unpatriotic not to stand up, to look them in the eye, and ask the questions they don't want to hear, they being those who have the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility, of sending our sons and daughters, our husbands, wives, our blood, to face death." Close quote. At least as quoted in this article, Rather falls short of stating the obvious, that the acceptance by the American people of the lies and obfuscation can be laid at the feet of Rather and the corporate-controlled media of which he is a part, as it was they who distributed government lies, propaganda, and obfuscation, as if these were the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. If Rather and his colleagues voice doubts and ask tough questions, public confidence and support for government action would change. And the people controlling the American media know that, as our speakers tonight will show. Our speakers tonight are all members of what our first speaker, reporter Jeremy Scahill, calls rebel media, those free voices outside the control of the puppeteers who pull Dan Rather's strings, and not only in terms of the war on terrorism. We'll look at the depth of self-censorship and censorship from above, and at corporate media and government collaboration in this limiting of news and information to the American public, and its impact on society through the eyes of several people on the front lines of the fight for a real free press in America.
I first came to know Jeremy a number of years ago when he was living in the Catholic Worker House in New York and was traveling around with the Berrigans. Since then, I've had the pleasure of working with him as he has covered some of the U.S.-sponsored wars around the globe the last several years, including the U.S. bombing of Iraq in 1998, the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, and most recently he's been covering Afghanistan remotely for Free Speech Radio News. Very pleased to have Jeremy Scahill with us tonight, and we'll have a presentation and then time for question and answer after that.
What has our president told us, dear president told us over the last couple of months? He said, we're going to smoke them out. We're going to get them running. We're going to hunt them down. We're going to chase them out of their holes. We're going to get the folks who did this. Freedom was attacked and freedom will be defended. And then in his classic capturing of the English language, Mr. Bush said, they've misunderestimated me and they've misunderestimated America. Among the goals of the Bush administration in this lovely so-called war on terror was Bin Laden wanted dead or alive, and Mullah Omar wanted dead or alive. Now, both of those guys are still nowhere to be seen, nowhere to be found whatsoever. In fact, did you guys see those ridiculous composite sketches they have now of Osama Bin Laden, like the one where he has the Yankees cap on, and, you know, I think he has an FDNY t-shirt on in one of them, too. So they have they're generating these ridiculous sketches of Bin Laden and all these stories about where he could possibly be. So we haven't achieved that goal. We, meaning the Bush administration, pardon my attachment of myself to the Bush administration, like so much of the media do these days. But then a lesser known goal of this was articulated by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who really appears as sort of a Nazi doctor at those press conferences. You know, he gets praised on Fox News for how clever he is and how he handles the press and explains to them, you can do this, you can't do that. But this is really an extraordinary statement to be made by a Secretary of Defense, and it should go down in the history of absolutely shocking remarks from U.S. officials. Rumsfeld was asked in the first several days after September 11th, how are you going to define victory in this war on terror? And Rumsfeld always had a different answer for it, generally about how we're going to wipe out terrorism around the world. And then when things didn't start to go so well, then it was, you know, we want to get rid of the Taliban and we want to force Al-Qaeda. And he started sounding like Bush. But one day he said, victory is creating a world with powerful weapons and powerful people not afraid to use them. Think about it. It's an extraordinary statement. What on earth does that have to do with this so-called war on terror? It slipped past so many people. It wasn't quoted the next day in the newspapers. It wasn't the clip that was taken from TV. It was part of the live press conference, and I think it was said and it was gone in sort of a moment. But again, victory is creating a world with powerful weapons and powerful people not afraid to use them. And if you think about it, that's exactly what this so-called war on terror is about. It's not about the Taliban. It's not about Osama bin Laden or Bush's father's friends from the Mujahideen. This is about resurrecting everything that those guys loved from the Cold War, throwing in the Gulf War, throwing in Somalia, throwing in every filthy, dirty U.S. intervention that's happened in the past 50 years and making it all one. The defense contractors are loving this. There's unprecedented unity in the Congress. Only Russ Feingold voted against the anti-terrorism bill. Only Barbara Lee voted against the bombing of Afghanistan. And so we have this tremendous unity, they say. United we stand. And so they're not achieving any of the goals that they've stated to the American people, but they're doing a damn good job of resurrecting the Cold War and adding to it overt military action and covert military action. Dick Cheney, from his bunker somewhere, is running this dirty war. And he said, we need to put unsavory people back on the CIA payroll. Well, I doubt that they'd ever be taken off, or have been taken off. But the fact that Dick Cheney is now saying this openly, these are things that we've seen before in American history. Nothing is new about what Bush is doing right now. There's absolutely nothing. They say this is a different kind of war. This isn't different from anything. This is the war that the United States has been waging for decades. Some would say for more than a century. So they haven't achieved any of the goals that they've stated to the American people, but what they have achieved is slaughtering more innocent civilians than were killed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I'm sure I don't have to tell people in this room about the report that was done by Professor Mark Harold of the University of New Hampshire. What he did was he went through all mainstream media accounts and some regional media accounts, and he cross-referenced the number of civilians who were reportedly killed, according to the media, in various days of bombing since October 7th. And as of 2 weeks ago, he put the toll at more than 3,700. You can find his report online, but he explains the methodology that he used for coming up with that number and cross-referencing things a number of times and making sure that the numbers were solid according to established press reports. So they've now killed more than 3,700 civilians to avenge the deaths of approximately the same number of people. I remembered what Dave Dellinger, the great legendary activist, said, actually wrote, when the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he talked about the way in which that act, the immediate incineration of hundreds of thousands of people, wiped out any allegiance that any American owes to this government. And right now we're being told by the Attorney General John Ashcroft that to criticize his policies is to side with the terrorists. George Bush is saying either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. You're with us or against us. And I think these are times that beg us to be courageous people. And we have to say clearly that to be a patriot in America today under these circumstances is to be a dissident. No one is going to come and knock on any of our doors and say, now is the time in your life when you need to stand up and scream out no. No one's going to come and knock on your door and say, now is the time to stand up for the voiceless people of Afghanistan who have been terrorized by U.S. bombs. No one is going to stand up and say, to you, now's the time for you to speak out against the slaughter of Iraqi civilians. That's something that needs to come from community groups like this. It needs to be a bottom-up thing. It starts with the small vigils. It starts with the publications. It starts with community radio like WORT. But no one's going to knock on your door and say, hey, this is the movement of your lifetime. This is the movement that you have to be a part of. And that's one of the problems with the left in America today, is we're all waiting for that knock on the door, and it's not going to come. It has to come from within us. And it's shocking to see the lack of dissent right now in America across the board. My family lives in Milwaukee, and one of their neighbors came and knocked on the door and asked them why they don't have a flag up. Like it's some kind of neighborhood requirement or something. I was telling my mom she should put up a white flag. And another extraordinary thing about this bombing is the testing of their toys and their equipment, these daisy cutter bombs. They brag about it being the most powerful bomb short of a nuclear bomb. These are 15,000-pound munitions. Imagine that, 15,000-pound. They're the size of like one of those old Volkswagen Beetles. And they can't even be dropped from a plane. They have to be pushed out the back of a plane by Marines. And then they descend with a parachute, and they have a 3-foot probe that sticks out on them. And when the probe hits the ground, they suck up everything within a 600-yard radius. It's gone. It's completely gone. And they leave an enormous crater in the ground. And the United States was using those when they were talking about the carpet bombing in Mazar-e-Sharif in the north of Afghanistan. That's what they were using. And these things implode and suck everything into the center. They completely wipe out all life within a 600-yard radius, and they were using these things regularly. And the cluster bombs. I have experience with what cluster bombs can do to people from Yugoslavia, where the United States was widely using them. These are one of the most horrifying munitions in the U.S. arsenal. But the cluster bombs drop from an airplane, and they look like a little canister. And when they're making their descent, and they break up into smaller canisters, and they spread out over the radius of 7 football fields. And then right before they hit the ground, they shred into tiny pieces of shrapnel. They turn everything in its path into shredded beef. These were used on human beings directly in both in Iraq, in Yugoslavia, and now in Afghanistan. In fact, there are still villagers in remote parts of Afghanistan who are surrounded. Their villages are surrounded by cluster bombs, and they're facing starvation because they can't get out of their homes because they're surrounded by them. And they're very colorful. They're yellow. And so many are the stories of children going up and touching a cluster bomb because it's something colorful. There's something appealing about them. And one can't help but wonder, is it intentional that they make them that color? And you could say, well, that's very cynical, but the very use of these weapons is cynical. And to add to all of that cynicism, then they mistakenly made their snack packets that they were dropping on Afghanistan the identical color to the cluster bombs. So the poor, desperate people living in a repressive regime, being bombed by another repressive regime, are running out to get their peanut butter sandwich and ketchup that the U.S. has generously donated to them. And several people were killed in that manner, and several children were killed. And it was reported widely in the European press, and it wasn't making the newspapers here. These cluster bombs are absolutely devastating, and like a nuclear bomb, they continue to kill after they're dropped. It's not just an immediate impact. It kills the people in the vicinity. They continue to kill. The United States has also recently confirmed that it's using depleted uranium munitions in Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time in the south of Iraq, in Basra, where the rates of childhood leukemia and basic cancers have risen 1/3 since the Gulf War. I remember sitting in a hospital in Basra with a woman whose husband was an Iraqi veteran and who lived in Basra, and it was the first time that she had been in a hospital, and she was 8 months pregnant. And they did an ultrasound on her, and they discovered that that her child had no brain while we were sitting with her. They discovered that her child had no brain and that her baby she was going to have to go through the process of labor and her child would die. And it was a direct result of the fact that her husband and she were both exposed to tremendous amounts of depleted uranium munitions, highly radioactive. And it's not just the munitions of depleted uranium that they're using. They're firing off tens of thousands of rounds of these radioactive-coated bullets. But they're also using the depleted uranium as a balancing mechanism in their missiles because they're heavier and they create a bigger impact. And so the United States is again using these in Afghanistan, and they use them in Yugoslavia. They fired off more than 30,000 rounds of depleted uranium in Kosovo. So now people in Kosovo, in the south of Serbia, are living in an essentially polluted environment. And outside of Kosovo, in parts of eastern Serbia, That's the same case, and there's been documentation by Yugoslav scientists already on increases in cancer rates among people who were exposed to the depleted uranium. So this cycle is not only continuing, it's being escalated. And as the Bush administration now looks to the next target, perhaps Iraq, perhaps Somalia, perhaps the Sudan, perhaps Yemen, perhaps the world, this is a man who was not elected president who's declared war on the world. The kinds of weapons that are being used right now need to be resisted as deeply as the age of the advent of the nuclear bomb. The nuclear bomb, of course, needs to be resisted, but the nature of these weapons are so insidious right now that they're using. We all need to pay attention to the details of the kinds of weapons that are found in the U.S. arsenal. I want to talk for a few minutes about what I was asked to speak about, and then I want to go back to talking about this so-called war on terror. Thomas Friedman, who was the great foreign policy writer of the New York Times, he's there, he's the man. When the bombing of Yugoslavia started, Thomas Friedman wrote a column in which he pointed out that Slobodan Milosevic was democratically elected. What's Thomas Friedman doing saying something like that when the U.S. is attacking? I mean, the U.S. is attacking a democratically elected government, Mr. Friedman? And he said that Slobodan Milosevic was democratically elected, and therefore it's not just about him and his regime and his paramilitaries and his killers and his ethnic cleansers. It's also about the Serbian people, because they elected him. This is not a war against Slobodan Milosevic. All of the Serbs need to be bottled up, so Thomas Friedman said. And he said, every day you ravage Kosovo is another century that we are going to set your country back. You want 1859, we can do 1859. You want 1389, we can do that too. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times. And so today, the entire media are like Thomas Friedman. We have the Fox News channel where they're talking about the one-eyed cyclops, Mullah Muhammad Omar, bin Laden with the diaper on his head, Dan Rather appearing just a couple of days after September 11th, saying that George Bush is the commander-in-chief, he just needs to say the word and I'm there. This is the anchor of one of the major newscasts in this country. And of course, this room isn't shocked by that kind of a statement. The American people were assured by it. They felt, you know, Dan Rather is one of us. Geraldo Rivera, the war correspondent for Fox News. Someone tell me what war he covered, and I'd like to see the coverage. He spent the entire Yugoslavia war in northern Albania, having never stepped foot inside of Kosovo during the war at all. Before he left to go cover the cover up the Afghanistan war, he was interviewed on Fox News, and he said, you know, in all the wars I've covered, I've come to realize one thing, that there are just some conflicts where there's only one side to it. And this is one of those conflicts. We have to support our freedom fighters from the Northern Alliance. Geraldo must not have read Human Rights Watch report on General Rashid Dostum, documenting how in 1998 he killed 2,000 innocent civilians in Afghanistan. These are the crooks, the killers that we've now backed and put into power in Afghanistan. So Geraldo's off with his buddies from the Northern Alliance. And what's interesting is Geraldo paid something in the ballpark of $20,000 to $30,000. I don't recall the exact figure, but it's been documented in the press. $20,000 to $30,000 to a gang of armed thugs to get him into Afghanistan. And now think about this. So we see this footage of overjoyed Afghans, happy to see Geraldo, happy to see the U.S. forces, happy to see the Taliban gone, happy to see the Northern Alliance coming into town. And it appears as though, wow, this was a tremendous success. We've liberated yet another people. But I've been on the ground in situations where you capture this kind of footage as a TV journalist. And what you're not seeing on that camera is that this group of villagers over here appears to be speaking with Geraldo Rivera or the guy from ABC or NBC or Seymour BS or whichever network happens to be doing it. And so it appears as though this journalist is doing a heart-wrenching interview with these people talking about the repression of the Taliban and how glad they are to see the Northern Alliance. That's the main point, really, is how glad they are to see U.S. forces in the Northern Alliance. Not so much about the Taliban, who are now referred to as the Arabs. So what you don't see is the gang of thugs behind Geraldo Rivera that are protecting him, that are from the Northern Alliance, that are staring at these villagers. If I were those villagers, even if I loved the Taliban, if my husband was Mullah Muhammad Omar, I'm going to say I love the Northern Alliance. You have this gang of thugs. It was a classic scenario in Kosovo. KLA, Kosovo Liberation Army, thugs were hired by CNN and Fox and ABC and CBS to go around and conduct interviews. They were translators. These guys were the other day killing Serbian police officers and torching Serbian villages and harassing and murdering Albanians who didn't side with them. And the next day, they're serving as a translator for CNN. You think villagers are going to say to these people, we're scared of the KLA? No, we support the KLA. And that's the side. I mean, when you're on the ground in those situations, you see extraordinary intellectual dishonesty on the part of journalists. Inherent to hiring armed, murderous thugs from the Northern Alliance is you're going to get a great story about how great the Northern Alliance is. And that's what we're seeing a lot of on TV. And so you have to keep all of those kinds of things in perspective. How was this information gathered when you see interviews with people hailing the arrival of U.S. forces? And there's all this discussion about the burqa. The women of Afghanistan are going to throw off the burqa, and they're overjoyed to throw off the burqa. And that was the favorite. In the Fox correspondent, Steve Harrigan's running around. He's got a burqa on, and he's life behind the burqa with Steve Harrigan. It was a special one night on Fox. And he puts it over the camera, and he's walking around. This is what the women see in Kabul. And they're talking. And okay, I mean, I don't really have a political opinion about the burqa. I don't think anybody should be forced to wear anything in any society, whether you're a woman or a man or a child. But if someone chooses to wear that, either for religious reasons or for cultural reasons, it's not for America to say, oh, that's repressive that the women are wearing that. If anyone's forced to do it, of course it is. But let me tell you what I think the greatest act of repression, short of killing and whipping people in Afghanistan has been, was when the U.S. military flew in the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders to do a strip show for American forces in Kandahar. And did people see this? Unbelievable. It's these drooling American forces with their video cams grabbing, wanting to put a dollar in the woman. I mean, they're doing this. They're doing this inside of an Islamic country. I mean, it was unreal to watch this. I forget who it was, but Mariah Carey just performed at Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, did her little strip show too. And it's, we're talking about the repression of women in Afghanistan, and there certainly are tremendous issues there. But look at what U.S. forces are doing as well, the liberators, the freedom lovers, the Democrats. There was an interest during the bombing in Yugoslavia. There was an extraordinary scene at the Hyatt Hotel. The Hyatt Hotel is this like epic building in Belgrade, and it's where all the journalists come. And it was anywhere between $150 to $250 a night for journalists to stay there. And it was the only place in Belgrade that was pretty much guaranteed to have electricity 24/7. Hospitals, when NATO would drop these graphite bombs, which spread out over an electrical system, and they essentially shut it down, and a tiny little part of this, it's like a hair. If you drop that into your hard drive of your computer, it's gone. It's not going to work anymore. So they were draping these things over the electrical supplies in Belgrade. It looked like moss sort of hanging down over it, and it would wipe out the electricity sometimes for several days or weeks. And Belgrade is still on a very, in some parts of the city, on a very old-fashioned system where if part of it is knocked down, that's it. That is the source of electricity. No power generator, no backup supply, none of that. So they were dropping these graphite bombs all around Belgrade. And on several occasions, they dropped it over electrical supplies, which were needed by hospitals. And when you drop, when you cut out the electricity in a hospital with premature babies in incubators, it's minutes that those children have in those incubators. And several children died in those incubators. And my wife was working as a translator for foreign journalists during the bombing. She's from Yugoslavia and was working as a translator and fixer. And she was in a hospital one night, and this happened, and a woman's child died. And the journalists are saying to her, go up and ask her how she feels. Go ask her what she's thinking about right now. Her daughter has just died. Go up and ask her how does she feel. I visited a neighborhood one time in Belgrade, and outside of Belgrade, after it had been very heavily bombed with cruise missiles. And we had heard that it had been hit. We went out there. The missiles were still smoking. And we walked up the road, and we came across this beautiful house that look, it had artists built this house written all over it. It was gorgeous, and it had a very big sort of open window space, a huge open window space in one part of that had been completely smashed, and it was about as tall as this ceiling. It was a very high ceiling on the first floor. And when you got a little bit closer, you saw that there was pottery and sculpture and paintings, beautiful, that had all been smashed by this cruise missile. And we approached the house, and it's a young couple that's living there, and they're artists. And they're digging through the rubble of their house. And they probably had saved up generations to build this place. It was like their dream. And we walk in, and they agree to sort of show us around their house, and they spoke English, and they were, you know, sharing with us. They had just lost their house and their life's work, and they're sharing with us, you know, how they felt. And this other journalist from a big newspaper in London comes in, and he says to them, not hello, not hi, I'm so-and-so, you know, not do you mind if I ask you some questions? So what happened here? Shrapnel had gone through their son's pillow directly, and just by some grace, they had happened to have taken their kids to the basement that night when they heard the roar of the planes. But I remember standing in this kid's bedroom, his toys scattered everywhere, the window broken, and shrapnel through the center of the pillow. If their son was sleeping in that bed, he would have been killed. And the callousness, it's the culture that we grow up in that permits journalists to only see this as the story and not as the people. Asking Ivana, ask her what she feels like. Ask her what she's thinking. What happened here? These stories are replicated 1,000 times over in every single conflict. And it's most oftentimes the journalists from the United States and Britain who are conducting themselves in this manner. People who are from countries that have felt the scourge of war or U.S.-sponsored war don't ask those kinds of questions when they walk into a house where that's just been destroyed by cruise missiles. So back to the Hyatt Hotel in Belgrade. You can get any food you want at the Hyatt Hotel in Belgrade during the bombing. You know, you got people waiting in hours in line for oil and sugar, if it's even around, bread, any basic food. You know, people are living, big parts of the country are living in absolute darkness. These people are living like, you know, kings. I want a Caesar salad today. How about a hamburger? You know, I feel like Taco Bell tonight. You know, anything you want is in there. And they're getting their massages from the, you know, from the Serbs who are being bombed. And, you know, there's the New York Times is feeling good. The back's all loosened up now. I can go back to the hot tub. And, you know, you can get a manicure, a pedicure, all these things in the Hyatt. Meanwhile, the kids are dying in the incubators. They're hanging out in the Hyatt. Send their translator out to gather a few quotes from some people. I mean, it was considered like a luxurious assignment to go there and hang out at the Hyatt and hire a couple Serbs to go out and do some interviews. And so anyway, there was an article by a reporter named John Simpson from the BBC that appeared in the Sunday Telegraph in Britain. And Simpson's writing on how he had suffered an injury during the bombing. And he wrote this up in the newspaper. It was a big deal. Just, you know, Simpson inside of Serbia's hospitals, you know, during the bombing, the Serb hospital. And so, you know, one would read it and think, you know, was it one of Milosevic's guys who did something to John when he was hunting down the story? Or was it a right-wing paramilitary in the country that had sort of cornered him and he miraculously got out? You never find out in the article. Well, it turns out that good old John had one too many drinks in the hot tub at the Hyatt, and getting out of it, slipped and sprained his ankle. And that's how he ended up in the hospital. So this is, you know, it's war injury. And at the Hyatt Hotel, it's like, you know, it's like this frat boy scene. You know, they're all hanging out, and they're laughing it up and yucking it up and having a grand old time. You know, the country's being bombed. And you know, hey, buddy, you know, you paid for these bombs. How can you be sitting in this hotel getting your back rubbed by these people? There's no conscience whatsoever on the part of so many of these guys. I mean, you do have some extraordinary journalists. Paul Watson from the LA Times was fantastic. Robert Fisk, who's regularly on WORT, who very nearly got killed in Pakistan. Again, there's a Hyatt Hotel in most of these conflict zones. I'm sure one's sprouted out right now in Kabul, where they're all staying. I like Baghdad's response, though, to the journalist hotel, the Al Rashid. Has this mosaic, a huge mosaic when you walk into the hotel, and it's Bush's father's face, it's Bush the elder, on the thing, and it says, Bush is a war criminal. And so in order to go into the hotel, you have to step on Bush's face to get in. So that was but actually, the place where that, I mean, this is very serious, so the place where Bush's face is on the floor there in Mosaic was also a place where two workers from that hotel were killed by U.S. bombs. And that's why Bush is a war criminal is placed in that particular place. You know, and talking about covering U.S.-sponsored wars, I mean, I think it's also important to look at the way that the United States has targeted media. You know, we talk about, you know, Milosevic was, you know, restricting press freedoms in Yugoslavia, and absolutely he was. And, you know, no free press in Iraq, I mean, not even a TV in Kabul, which isn't that bad of a thing. But you know, the United States did something that was really unprecedented in the Yugoslavia bombing. They put on the target list Radio Television Serbia. They actually listed it as a target to be bombed, and then they bombed Radio Television Serbia and killed 16 of the workers there. Now, these weren't Milosevic's celebrity journalists. These weren't we can name off who those people are, but not a single one of them was in the building that night. Not a single one of Milosevic's chief propagandists were in the building that night. The people who worked the third shift are not the celebrities. The people that were in that building, the overwhelming majority of them were makeup artists, technicians, engineers that were killed in that bombing. And they tried to sue the United States. They tried to bring charges against the U.S. at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, and that was rejected by Carla Del Ponte, the chief war crimes prosecutor. She said that the U.S. committed no war crimes. Human Rights Wing Watch said that that was not a war crime, the bombing of Radio Television Serbia. Their case was the families now tried to sue NATO in the European Court of Human Rights, and they threw it out. Established power in the world refuses to recognize the killing of those 16 journalists as a war crime or a crime of any nature. And in the most recent bombing of the United States, the bombing of Afghanistan, they also bombed Al Jazeera television, their offices. And thank God no one from Al Jazeera was in the building. But they bombed Al Jazeera intentionally because Al Jazeera was the only media outlet that was actually providing footage of what was on the other side of the barrel of the gun. We see this side of the barrel of the gun, but we don't see this side. Most of the world looks up at the gun. We look down at them from our cameras. Our guns from the United States and our cameras are pointed this way, and everyone else is looking that way, and that's what Al Jazeera was doing. They also bombed the Associated Press, you know, which is generally an outlet for Colin Powell's latest press release, and they bombed the BBC. In fact, the BBC correspondent was on live when their office got hit on camera. He was on a video phone, and you just see it just smashes in, and the room explodes. You know, and he and his people run for cover. And you know, but the U.S. was targeting journalists. And you know, it's interesting when Radio Television Serbia was bombed. Myself and a couple of other journalists and people from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting contacted the Committee to Protect Journalists because their annual report for 1999 had come out, and there was no listing of the 16 journalists of Radio Television Serbia had been killed. And so, you know, we made a couple of innocent calls. You must have left this out. You must have forgotten it. You know, these 16 journalists were killed. You know, anyone who's killed by, like, a death squad somewhere is going to be on that list, as they should be. But anyone who's killed by U.S. That was a legitimate target. In fact, that's what the Committee to Protect Journalists told us. That was a legitimate target. Those weren't journalists; they were propagandists. And let me tell you something. You know who the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists is? A woman named Kitey Martin. You know who she is? Richard Holbrooke's wife. Richard Holbrooke was the trigger man on the bombing of Yugoslavia. He's probably the guy who said, "Let's hit Radio Television Serbia." You know, so his wife is the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and she's the one saying, in her defense of journalists around the world, that these weren't journalists; they were propagandists. What is Fox News today? What is CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC? We have, folks, we have state media in this country. And the thing is that because there's no line drawn by the American people between the corporations and the government, it's state media. These people are on the same team, just like Milosevic and his media cronies are on the same team. This is state media, but we don't think of it in that way. CNN's just much more sophisticated. They speed up the tapes for the Pentagon so that it makes it look like, oh, when we bombed that train, it was just that the pilot couldn't get his, you know, the trigger moved fast enough, and so we directly hit the train, and we decapitated a Serbian Orthodox priest in that bombing, and whoops! You know, that's state media. And it's and it's patriotic media. You know, the we go from, we bounce from the State Department to the Pentagon to the White House to check out what Ari Fleischer is going to say, and then we go back to the Pentagon and let's talk to some retired generals and then a retired admiral and then this special ops guy, and that's what's on TV all day long. And that's what's in the papers the next day all day long. And that's how it goes. And there's no, you know, there's no examination whatsoever of the causes behind what happened on September 11th. You know, I remember watching, he's a very right-wing, generally bad reporter, this guy T.R. Reid for the Washington Post, he writes out of Europe. And he was being interviewed on Christian Amanpour's new show on CNN International, something called, like, you know, war correspondent, like they all are now. And T.R. Reid was saying, you know, I've been trying to do a story about looking at why the rest of the world hates America so much, but my editors aren't, you know, aren't really, they said it's too hot. You know, and I'm sure that this guy's piece was going to have nothing to do with the sanctions against Iraq or the, you know, Israeli slaughtering of the Palestinians with U.S. weapons or, you know, God forbid East Timor and the history of the U.S. could be mentioned with that. I mean, it's probably something about how, this is the classic line, they hate us because we have two cars and McDonald's and shopping malls. You know, the Wall Street Journal did a poll shortly after September 11th of what they called moneyed Arabs. Moneyed Arabs, businessmen, lawyers, stockbrokers in Muslim countries in the Middle East who have close business ties to the United States. And 70% of these guys said that they despised America because of its policy in Iraq and its support for Israel. And these are moneyed Arabs. These are cronies of people in Washington. And so, if that's their perspective, as to why the United States is hated so much, or why they despise the American government, largely people around the world don't hate Americans, but they live on the other side of the barrel of that gun, and they have very good reason to be against what the United States is doing to them. I mean, imagine what the sentiments are on Main Street, but it's still portrayed in the American press because we have our McDonald's. They're jealous of us, and so they blow up the World Trade Center. So, corporate media in this country and around the world, they're whitewashing the extent to which America is responsible for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in the way that I just said, in the sense of we don't want to examine what was behind September 11th, but also in not telling the story of the extraordinary U.S. support for the Islamic fundamentalists. There is an unbelievable new book out that has not been published in America yet. It's written. It was written by two French journalists, and one of them was a former member of the French secret police, and the other was one of the top investigative journalists in France. And the book is called "Bin Laden: The Forbidden Truth," and it should be out sometime by the end of February. You know, a lot of people, I'm sure, in this room have been doing a lot of research, and I saw Alan's article in the No War Times about the oil connection in Afghanistan, and I think it's something that a lot of us are, of course, examining and paying attention to and trying to, as always, figure out what's the real motive behind this. And in Afghanistan, I mean, it's pretty clear because it goes back for decades, and a lot of people are familiar with the pipeline. But with the Bush administration in power, it takes on a new dimension, the oligarchy. You know, Vice President Dick Cheney, of course, was the president of Halliburton, which is one of the largest companies in the world that provides services for the oil industry. They're also getting contracts secretly in Iraq to do construction, and now they're one of the top investors itching to get into Serbia to do reconstruction as well. Now that NATO did $60 billion worth of damage. Then you have the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. She was a director for Chevron at the time when Amy Goodman and myself documented the killing of two Nigerian activists with the direct participation of the Chevron Oil Corporation in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, people who were protesting against Chevron's massacring of their environment and their land. People occupied a barge in this remote village in the Niger Delta to protest, and Chevron sent in the most brutal forces of Nigeria, the mobile police known as the Kill and Go, because they kill a village and they go. Sent them in on Chevron helicopters, and they opened fire on the barge of nonviolent unarmed protesters, and they wounded 30 people and they killed two others. Condoleezza Rice was a director at Chevron when that happened. And she's now the national security advisor. And a judge in San Francisco recently ruled that a case against Chevron for murder can go forward. And if Chevron's convicted, which they won't be, they could lose their corporate charter. So we have Dick Cheney, Halliburton, Condoleezza Rice, Chevron. Then you've got Donald Evans and Spence Abram. Both of them work for another oil giant. And also many of the officials that the U.S. now has working directly in Afghanistan have direct ties to multinational oil corporations. Hamid Karzai, the head of the interim government, was an advisor to UNICAL, as is the U.S. envoy, who is there right now, who's an Afghan-American. So you have this oligarchy, and the oligarchy is extending into Afghanistan. And this new book that just came out in France is revealing extraordinary details of the extent to which U.S. oil corporations influenced the Bush administration's policies toward Afghanistan prior to September 11th. And the main thrust of the book is that it was under the influence of these oil companies that the Bush administration blocked the FBI and CIA investigations into Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda network. And what they were hoping, there's an official quote in the book, a Bush administration official quote in the book, who said that the Taliban are seen by the Bush administration, this is prior to September 11th, as a, quote, source of stability in Central Asia that would enable the construction of a pipeline across Central Asia from the rich oil fields in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. Now, also in this, it's extraordinary. But it's not the most mind-blowing statement in the book. The authors of the book document how, before the September 11th attacks, Christina Rocha, who's the head of Asian Affairs at the U.S. State Department, met with the Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zaif, in Islamabad on August 2nd. And Rocha, of course, the people who followed Afghanistan, is a veteran of U.S. involvement there. She was previously in charge of contacts with the Mujahideen and guerrilla groups at the CIA. And she oversaw the delivery of the Stinger missiles that everyone's talking about to the Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. So she was meeting with him, recognizing him, legitimacy. And it also talks about how the Taliban actually hired an American public relations expert for this international image-making campaign. And what's amazing about it is that it was a woman that they hired, on the one hand. But the thing that's even more extraordinary is who she is. Her name is Layla Helms. You got two choices as to who she's related to. She's the niece of the former CIA director, Richard Helms. And Layla Helms is sort of described as the Mata Hari of U.S. Taliban relations. And she brought a top advisor to Mullah Omar to Washington in March of 2001, like the right-hand man of Mullah Muhammad Omar to Washington in 2001, March of 2001, right after they had destroyed the ancient Buddha statues. You know. And this right-hand man of Mullah Muhammad Omar met with the Directorate of Central Intelligence at the CIA and then went on to the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department. So in March of 2001, Mullah Muhammad Omar's right-hand man is running around having chats with the CIA, with the State Department, and prior to that, they had sent the delegation to Texas to meet with UNICAL, oil executives. Business was being done with these guys. Profits were being pursued. The repression wasn't an issue. The burqas were unheard of. The Bush administration wasn't concerned about any of that. The book also documents how the deputy director of the FBI, John O'Neill, resigned in July of last year in protest of the Bush administration's blocking of their investigation of al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, essentially telling them back off. And so he resigned in protest. And then he goes on to be head of security at the World Trade Center and was killed there on September 11th. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. And it's you know, what's really amazing is the way I heard about this is I had read a couple of reviews in sort of in Indian and Pakistani press, or as Bush calls them, the Pakis. You know, this is an extraordinary guy we have as president. And the other day, you know, we're flipping around the tube and we see Paul Azan. Remember, you know, Paul Azan, sexy, sexy, sexy. Did you guys see those ads? There were these ads that ran on CNN last weekend. Paul Azan, and it said something like, you know, I mean, I don't watch CNN that often, even though I can talk about it. But they said this. What journalist is intelligent? And it shows her, like, writing something, you know. Informative, she's talking something, you know. And hard-hitting, and she's questioning, you know, one of the retired generals. And then it said, you know, and then you know, sexy flashes on the screen, and you hear the sound of like a zipper. You know, and it's like, you know, watch Paul Azan every morning, blah, 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 on CNN. So I was watching Paul Azan, you know, this particular morning on CNN. Not for that reason, but I was just having a look. And she says, you know, we're going to talk about this explosive new book on how the Bush administration allegedly was blocking, you know, the investigation of Al-Qaeda before September 11th. And I was like, oh, my God. Is this CNN I'm watching? I mean, this is amazing. So then they go to the two French authors, and they're sitting there. One's here and one's there. And Paul Azan asks them a question, and the guy begins to say what I just told you, and she cuts him off and then asks another question, and the same guy answers it. And she says, okay, well, I want to thank you guys for joining us. The other guy didn't say a word. And he's just looking there stunned, like, why, what? The interview's over? The whole thing lasted about 45 seconds. And then they went on to talk then to Richard Butler, the former head of the weapons inspection program in Iraq. And then Richard Butler goes on for like 15 minutes talking about how this book is full of crap. And so that's how CNN covered this issue. The other thing is I don't know if you guys have heard of this this company called the Carlyle Group. I don't know how many, some people probably have, but this is also an extraordinary. Noam Chomsky always says that, you know, if you really want to find out what's going on in the world, you should read the financial press. And it's remarkable how much you discover from reading the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. But there's this magazine, it's a venture capitalist magazine called Red Herring Magazine. Redherring.com, it's an unbelievable magazine. And there was a piece in it. If you guys, if it's okay with people, if you're not getting bored with me, I can read you part of this piece. And it's unbelievable. It's called Carlyle's Way, Making a Mint Inside the Iron Triangle of Defense, Government, and Industry. It's written on January 8th. So it begins, like everyone else in the United States, the group stood transfixed as the events of September 11th unfolded. Present were former Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of State James Baker, and representatives of the Bin Laden family. This was not some underground presidential bunker or Central Intelligence Agency interrogation room. It was the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C., the plush setting for the annual investor conference of one of the most powerful, well-connected, and secretive companies in the world, the Carlyle Group. And since September 11th, this little-known company has become unexpectedly important. That the Carlyle Group had its conference on America's darkest day was mere coincidence. But there is nothing accidental about the cast of characters that this private equity powerhouse has assembled in the 14 years since its founding. Among those associated with the Carlyle Group are former U.S. President George Bush, former U.K. Prime Minister John Major, and former President of the Philippines Fidel Ramos. And Carlyle has counted George Soros, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal bin Abdul Aziz Al-Saud of Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden's estranged family among its high-profile clientele. The group has been able to parlay its political clout into a lucrative buyout practice, in other words, purchasing struggling companies, turning them around and selling them for huge profits, everything from defense contractors to telecommunications and aerospace companies. It's a kind of ruthless investing made popular by the movie Wall Street, and any industry that relies heavily on government regulation is fair game for Carlyle's brand of access capitalism. Carlyle has established itself as the gatekeeper between private business interests and U.S. defense spending. And as the Carlyle investors watched the World Trade Towers go down, the group's prospects went up. In running what its own marketing literature spookily calls a vast interlocking global network of businesses and investment professionals that operates within the so-called iron triangle of industry, government, and the military, the Carlyle Group leaves itself open to any number of conflicts of interest and stunning ironies. For example, it's hard to ignore the fact that Osama bin Laden's family members, who renounced their son 10 years ago, stood to gain financially from the war being waged against him until late October, when public criticism of the relationship forced them to liquidate their holdings in the firm. Or consider that U.S. President George W. Bush is in a position to make budgetary decisions that could pad his father's bank account. But for the Carlyle Group, walking that narrow line is the art of doing business at the murky intersection of Washington politics, national security, and private capital. Mastering it has enabled the group to amass $12 billion in funds under management. Perhaps even, this is another part of the article that I really want you guys to hear. Perhaps even more disconcerting than Carlyle's ties to the Pentagon are its connections with the White House itself. Aside from signing up George Bush Sr. shortly after his presidential term ended, Carlyle gave George W. Bush a job on the board of Texas-based airline food caterer Cater Air International back in 1991. It was a subsidiary of the Carlyle Group. So Bush was an employee of it. It's the 11th largest defense contractor in the United States. And yet no one has heard of the Carlyle Group in the world of defense. It's the 11th largest defense contractor. And they own a company called United Defense. And it makes this thing called a Crusader, which is this 42-ton self-propelled howitzer that moves and operates much like a tank and can lob 155-millimeter shells per minute as far as 40 kilometers. The Crusader has been in the sights of Pentagon budget cutters since the Clinton administration, which argued that it was a relic of the Cold War era, too heavy and slow for today's warfare. Even the Pentagon had recommended the program be discontinued, but remarkably, the $11 billion contract for the Crusader is still alive thanks largely to the Carlyle Group. While it is impossible to say what U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was thinking when he made the decision to keep the Crusader program alive, people close to the situation claim to have a pretty good idea. Frank Carlucci and Donald Rumsfeld are good friends and former wrestling partners from their undergraduate days at Princeton University. So it's extraordinary. This is a company that brings families together. It brings the Bin Ladens and the Bushes together. And they were one of the war profiteers, not just in the defense industry stuff. They took their company public shortly after September 11th and made an absolute killing. Absolute killing. And these are the kinds of forces that are rising in an unprecedented manner under the Bush administration. And so in wrapping up, I mean, we can talk about the oligarchy and the Bush presidency. We can talk about the Carlyle Group. We can talk about how the Bush administration blocked the investigation of Al-Qaeda in the interest of running this oil pipeline. But just talking about all of these things and just having information and researching on the web, all of us know that that's not enough. All of us know deep somewhere in our heart that we need to resist at this time. And I say again, when high school students are being suspended from their school for wearing shirts in protest of the bombing, when people are being snitched on at their club where they work out for wearing I don't like war t-shirts, when thousands of people are being detained in this country and we sit silent, we're responsible. And whether we're journalists or we're doctors or we're teachers or we don't have work at the present time, somewhere in all of our day we can find a way to stand up and say no every single day of our lives. There are two other things that I want to say, and then I'm going to stop, and hopefully we can have a discussion. One really interesting fact, I don't know much about Somalia, haven't followed it all that much, was sort of spurred to do a little bit of research by the recent events and the fact that Somalia is being talked about as the next target, and the fact that this wonderful movie, Black Hawk Down, is out. In Somalia, in late 1992 and 93, a consortium of oil companies discovered that there are billions and billions of dollars of oil and natural gas reserves in Somalia. There's a professor from the University of California, Berkeley, who's going to be issuing a report sometime in the next couple of weeks. Her name is Claudia Carr. and it's looking at oil companies' explorations inside of Somalia. There's also a very well-fortified military base in the north of Somalia that the Russians and the Americans have fought over for decades. So those are just, you know, and that's sort of the extent to which I sort of can speak about Somalia, but it's very interesting how the oil situation pops up in everything, even, you know, Somalia. And so when you go and watch Black Hawk Down, you got to keep in mind that before this all happened, before the U.S. came in and slaughtered Somalis, and then the Marines were dragged through, the Army Rangers were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu, that they had just discovered billions of dollars worth of oil reserves in Somalia. And so in closing, I want to go back and say that when we watch TV, when we read the newspaper, when we talk to people in our everyday lives who are just pumping up the Bush administration, the patriotism, the flags, you know, we're behind our president. Doesn't matter if we're a Democrat or Republican, and yes, a Green Party member. Doesn't matter any of that. We're all Americans, and we're united in this mass slaughter. Remember that it's the gun that comes from this country that is now pointed at the rest of the world. A man who was not elected president has declared war on the world. We are living in that country, and we have a responsibility to stand up, to scream out, to speak for people who have no voice, whether they're Americans in detention, or whether they're Afghanis who are being bombed, or whether they're Iraqis who live under the misery of a dictatorship and a horrific foreign policy from America. That's what America does best, is it punishes suffering people. And it targets people who are already suffering. And all of us in this room have a responsibility to stand up and say no. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Scahill speaking earlier this year in Madison, Wisconsin. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. Access to mass media has been severely limited by laws pushed through by corporate lobbies, which culminated in the greatest spectrum giveaway in history in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Many have turned to the Internet as the only place where equal access has been available to public interest journalism. Now the media telecom conglomerates are trying to close that door to free discourse in America. Next, Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy talks about the threat to the freedom of the Internet and the battle to save it. He spoke a few weeks ago in Seattle.
We're going to start with Jeff Chester. He's the director of the Center for Digital Democracy, and he'll lay the landscape of what is going on out there with regard to the threats to the Internet as well as some other issues. So, Jeff, would you like to come up?
Thank you. This is fantastic to be at a place that's devoted to real community media, and I want to thank you for inviting me. But you probably don't know that I'm one of the handful, unfortunately, of public interest progressive organizations working in Washington around these media and digital media issues. And one of the reasons why we haven't been able to make as much progress over the last 20 and 30 years has been the fact that the progressive community generally hasn't really understood the role that public policy plays. There's a whole history here. In the 80s, I was active in helping create the campaign, which eventually established the Independent Television Service within public broadcasting. But since the early 90s, I've been in Washington really there to sort of fight this particular moment. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm 53. And I have been following media issues, I know, for quite a long time. We, my colleagues and I, and I like the Media Access Project, which is the country's oldest and, of course, only public interest telecommunications law firm in Washington, Consumers Union, Consumer Federation of America. That rounds it out on the media ownership, believe it or not, open access side when it comes to our side. Four groups, and the fact that my tiny organization is a group should make you anxious. And then, of course, we have a great group like the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, which has done remarkable work, but principally focused on the issues of privacy versus the issues of media democracy and the future of the Internet broadly. So let me just sort of succinctly say what's going on as far as I can, what I believe. The vision that the media giants have for the future of new media is old media. It's always been clear, and that's really the threat. And they never intended, the Time Warners, you know, and the Universals and the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association, the lobbying infrastructure. They never intended, because I've been there now for 10, 11 years, and, you know, like you, I go to their conferences, I read their publications, you know, I follow them. I know them in many ways, which is why we and my colleagues have been able to expose them. But they immediately saw the internet as a threat, and they had no intention of allowing the internet to really develop as an alternative medium. This goes back to 10 years. The advertisers in particular. The advertisers did not want to see a medium develop that would truly offer people not only alternative approaches for information, but, God forbid, information for free without the branding experience, like all the brandwashing of America, that's at the heart of the vision. And so what you have now going on is a campaign, fairly coordinated in a way, on the part of the media giants that has received the support of official Washington. And although the Clinton folks were horribly corrupt, and when it comes to the future of the openness of the internet, were almost as bad, in Michael Powell, you sort of have potentially the James Watt, if you remember him, of media and telecom. So look, here's what, and you can't look at all these things in an isolated way, and a lot of people do. I'm not saying you guys do, but a lot of people in the press, it's all interrelated. So what are they trying to do? All right, they're working, and they've been successful now to eliminate the limit on how many cable systems a single company can own. They took it to court. Time Warner, Jerry Levin's legacy is they took it to court. They basically said it violates our First Amendment rights as a corporation to have any limits whatsoever. Now, God forbid, you know, the limit we had to end up with was 30%. No company could control more than 30%. That's now been overturned. So what's likely to happen is the limit's going to go up to 50%. Two companies will be able to control the entire cable television system. The television networks, of course, lobbied the 96 Act and got the digital spectrum for free, which is political leverage so they can get into cable systems. So I could talk about that if you wanted to. But the broadcast networks have challenged the limit on the number of stations any network can own. It had been 25 in the 96 Act. They wanted it 50. We fought them. We had to settle for 35. They went to court. They just got that overturned, in essence. So there won't be any limits on the number of television stations. You already know what's happened to radio. Every major newspaper company in this country, including the New York Times, right, and the Washington Post, are pursuing, along with their broadcast colleagues, to overturn a very critical safeguard that now prohibits the common ownership of a newspaper and a broadcast station in a single community. And I think the most important, the basic fundamental policy that has ensured the openness and non-discriminatory character of the internet is now being reversed as it moves to broadband. And these are interrelated. The cable industry understands that it has the principal wire that will deliver to most citizens and consumers, the majority of consumers and citizens, the broadband connections, you know, for the immediate future. So they have removed all the ownership limits so a handful of people can control it. And now they are successful in ending the open access requirements. And let me explain. I'm sure you followed this. The dial-up internet was based on the phone system. It grew up. It evolved. You know, its DNA was based on the common carrier network philosophy. The telephone wires had to carry all traffic. You've heard Larry Lessig and others talk. You guys have all probably written about it. The intelligence was at the edges. The person that owned the wire didn't own content. And more importantly, the phone network cannot discriminate against content. They have to let your content through and your content through on fair terms. That is today's internet. That has been a very important, powerful tool for us all. That's not what the media industry wants. Because ultimately, the media industry, particularly cable, who I see here as the most powerful negative forces, they've wanted all along to ensure that they could, I use the term, migrate their business model with television to the broadband environment. Their business model is, I control the wire, I control all the programming, and that's it. And you all know that you can't get on the cable unless you cut these guys in and all that stuff. All right? So what have they done? They have launched the campaign. They were very successful, unfortunately, under Clinton, who was, you know, horribly corrupt. The Bells have launched a similar campaign to end the open access policy. So here's what Michael Powell is doing. He announced he was coming up with a uniform policy for broadband. In February, released a proposal for the phone side called Wireline. In March, they released the proposal for cable modem service. In essence, they are declaring that it's not common carrier telecommunications, which is what we say it is. All right. They're saying it's an unregulated classification. It means that the company that controls the wire will be able to make all kinds of decisions about the terms of access for content. It means that ISPs will not have the full rights for interconnection. ISPs, we have more than 7,000 in this country, they will fade away. I was responsible with my colleagues for forcing the FTC to impose some open access requirements on AOL Time Warner as part of the merger. They have to do at least three, but you've had literally thousands. You're not going to have those anymore. And more importantly, they are going to, and they are, privatizing the architecture to ensure that their content, their applications, their branding vision is at the forefront of the experience that citizens and consumers have. Business models, you know, based on what I call paper packet, will emerge that will begin imposing hefty transport fees on streaming video content providers. Home screens will all be controlled. And then I want to sort of conclude by saying that I think it's very important that we fight to have as open a system as possible to ensure that alternative voices, community voices, and all kinds of other commercial voices, small, medium, even large, have access to the major platforms. And there's no question in my mind that they're migrating television, integrating television, which they see as bringing the power of popular culture to promote advertising and marketing with the interactivity online. That's where you have a lot of the privacy issues. It's going to be a very powerful medium. They intend to control it. The four groups, with ACLU as amicus, have taken the FCC's decision to court. The Ninth Circuit will hear it. We hope that you will join us, and hopefully you will work with us to raise this issue. I'm sure you already have in town halls and across the country. There's very little support. There's absolutely very little support, and the corporations have been able to basically buy up the support of a lot of the traditional public interest community. I say, if you look at the AOL Foundation website and the Verizon Foundation website and see all the groups, including the civil rights groups, that get money, they've been neutralized and given funding to work on digital divide issues instead of who will control this network.
Could you explain about the suit and how people, maybe the IMCs and various different organizations could be?
I think there may still be time, actually, to file a suit. Certainly, there's time to file an amicus. And I think, as important as participating, we got to promote it. I mean, you know, we have, as a community, we've not taken any corporate money, right? The Media Access Project, Consumers Union, et cetera, my group, we don't take corporate money. We live off the handful of remaining liberal foundations. So there's very little resources because the foundations ultimately don't really want to fund a media and democracy movement. They don't want to make these giant corporations really accountable to the public. It's a real sort of uphill battle. So our resources are limited. So having people discuss, having publications, talking about online, writing articles, there's a whole bunch of things, and we're going to be working on, hopefully, in the next couple of months, because we just filed the suit, to put more information out there. But that would be very important. However, look, in every community, we have to argue that there has to be an alternative vision. We have to expose the architectural plans. We have to expose the political operations in every community. Even though the communities have very little power around the cable system, I assume you remember the 1984 Cable Act. And in the 1984 Cable Act, see, I come in around 1979 as a reporter looking at cable and cable lobbying in California and seeing how they are making these promises and break them. Well, the cities and even the Alliance for Community Media are saying, well, cable broadband is a cable service, so they can get the franchise fee versus ensuring that it's a common carrier system. So, you know, people may not follow that, but, you know, the cities have basically benefited from the cable regulation and want broadband cable to be cable because they get 5% of gross revenue that goes into their general coffers. So, look, arguing that a town like Seattle and the adjoining communities articulating a broadband vision, exposing what they are trying to do, we can help you. We along with the ACLU, we're working on a pilot project in Portland to provide a blueprint so folks can look at the architecture. But I think we have to have just a lot of activism. I think we have to have a lot of anger, and I think we have to have a lot of information out there, and we have to put this issue up on the radar screen. Very few people know it's coming. It's harder and harder to get stories out, even in the print press, with all of this. You know, they see it as a boring story, but every time the LA Times has to write about this story, because I talk to their reporters every day, they know they've just been bought by the Tribune Company. When the New York Times has to write the story, well, last month they invested $100 million and became partner with the Discovery Channel. All right? Media consolidation has had a negative impact on the ability of journalists to really, I think, be brave and write critically about what's going on. Bill Moyers is an exception. He's going to do much more, and he started doing stuff. But it's really a very dire situation because you're going to have a handful of companies having even more political power. Their vision is just about selling. They're going to restructure the Internet in ways that will profoundly change its characteristics, and I'm afraid I think a lot of people are going to end up liking what they get, which is sort of, you know, Internet light. And it's going to weaken our goals for a more democratic and just society. So we hope we can work together.
Could you explain the whole Clear Channel?
The minute Clinton came in, I mean, some of us were so happy there was a Democrat, but the first words out of his mouth was deregulation, all right? So we were fighting him from day one. And in 96, when Republicans took over, then everything was going to go. All the things we're fighting now were really in the 96 Act, and I'd like to give us credit, my colleagues and I, because we were able to pull some of the bad stuff out that most people don't know, that we were able to pull stuff out, but we couldn't do anything to radio. We couldn't do anything, and they got rid of the limits. Now you can own, one company can own 8 stations in the community, and you have two. What? Two companies now own basically, you know, most of the channels, and there's no local programming and all that. I think it gives us a sense of what will happen. But I think that even radio and broadcasting, whatever happens, pales to what happens to broadband. Because on the broadband pipeline, you know, all this information ultimately will travel. That will be the central system for most folks here, right? That's what will be television. You know, that's what will be broadcasting. And having broadband open, let alone having the commons within broadband, you know, some part of that network that doesn't operate under the economic restraints that the big media companies intend to impose on the broadband delivery. Because remember, they have control over last mile. I mean, there's a lot of people who think we can bypass it, you know, through wireless networks and all that. I don't think that's practical. I think we have to have open access on all the main platforms. I think the wireline platform is going to be a dominant platform to the majority of households. They're going to subsidize access through advertising. I don't think we can have a sort of a readout around it. There are people who think we can. And interactive television, they're investing billions of dollars in interactive television. You know, PC penetration is expected to top off, or has topped off, at 50%, and they're thinking 50% of the folks are going to start using email and interactive TV. It's going to be a very important platform. We have to be there. It's my perspective. progressive, public interest, community, alternative voices have to be on the major platforms.
Do you think it's realistic to even consider a legal strategy to accomplish anything? Because even if you win at some lower court, it's going to eventually go to the Supreme Court and it's going to be reversed and then very bad precedent.
Is there a legal strategy here? Certainly, much more of a legal strategy needs to be created. And, you know, for example, there could be suits at the local level. Some of my colleagues believe that we might win the lower court and even the Supreme Court, which last week in a 7-1 decision actually supported the right policy in requiring the local phone networks to interconnect. So, look, I don't know. However, a legal strategy is important, but I also think a lot of effort in publicizing what is at stake, getting it out to community folks, getting it out to internet folks. You know, if all these things go through, when I said it, one company in one town will be able to own several TVs, several radios, the newspaper, the cable system, and the principal ISP. Tremendous political power. And by the way, here in Seattle, you have actually the only publisher who is opposed to the elimination of the broadcast newspaper rule, Frank Blethyn, to his credit. But everybody else is supporting it, yeah.
So besides a litigation strategy and a public outreach strategy, what other opportunities can we consider that would allow us to get outside of what I would call their orbit?
Yeah.
And you mentioned wireless, and even though you don't think that's a real strong alternative, could you at least talk about what you think that has the potential to be, or at least what others think it might have the potential to be as a way to kind of go around their stranglehold? And are there any other technology strategies or other strategies that allow us to figure out how to get outside of their orbit?
Yeah, you know, there are folks, there's a place called the New America Foundation, it's newamerica.yet, Yochai Benkler, B-E-N-K-L-E-R from NYU, is working with Larry Lessig on an open spectrum project on Wi-Fi and wireless, and clearly there's a lot of work being done. I guess my interest is not routing around. My interest is in fighting them to see if we can get access. I don't want to be, I think we'll be marginalized. So I think we have to do both. We have to fight. I mean, one thing, for example, is this issue has not resonated politically. I don't believe any of your congresspersons here, you know, certainly Cantwell, they are not taking the right position. I mean, Cantwell didn't even show up at the Comcast AT&T merger hearing. All right? So, you know, Washington, you folks could do also a big service by raising the visibility of this issue and what is at stake. And you should be fighting to deny the transfer, if it's not too late, of AT&T to Comcast. You should be creating a task force to look at the architecture that Comcast has in mind. You should be critiquing it, and you should have the resources with CPSR here to articulate a public interest vision for the greater Seattle area for a broadband, push your vision and show where they're pushing the blocks, where they're going to cash locally, and they're going to make sure that their content, their services get preferential treatment. I think we have to expose their plans are and create public consciousness and show what it's at stake. And this is one of the few issues that the progressives have where we can actually say we're also pro-business. Because the only people who are going to benefit from all these changes are the handful of big media companies and, you know, their affiliates. Even companies like Disney and Sony, believe it or not, are terrified, absolutely terrified about the power that Comcast and Time Warner and the handful of cable companies will have. Now, they're silent, Disney. They have to be silent because if they criticize Comcast, they won't get access. So imagine if Disney's afraid. What about all the even medium-sized businesses in town? Once they find out what the new transport arrangements, Brian Roberts intends to start imposing all kinds of fees on the delivery of broadband services, right? Which I think is going to negatively impact the ability of folks to compete and will harm the civic infrastructure of a community when all of a sudden nonprofits and others find that they can't afford to communicate because you had this last mile problem. So I think you can try to rat around. I urge you to try to rat around, but I think we have to fight to get in. And I think they're vulnerable because they're greedy.
Isn't Earthlink and Verizon also party to a suit?
Yeah, well, Earthlink has filed a suit, and Earthlink is an ally. And the only reason Earthlink is really around in a way is because the advocates forced the FTC to impose a minimum of three ISPs, unaffiliated ISPs. So Earthlink is fighting for its life. Verizon has filed a suit, and Verizon is running around campaigning against the AT&T Comcast merger, but it's a ruse. What Verizon and the Bells want is to end the open access policy. That's why they were behind a bill called Tozan Dingle, which just got a Senate version, just got introduced. They want to make trouble in the Comcast merger solely as a tactic to say, we want the same deregulatory treatment. All right? And they're funding folks to do stuff, and they're sending out, they've made an advocacy manual that the folks in Portland are passing out, Verizon. Be careful about Verizon. Well, yes, but where I think cable is important is that I think that ultimately for a lot of people it will be an entertainment service, and cable is going to be able to bundle its significant investment in content, and DSL may end being more of a business service, while residential consumers, a lot of households, end up getting cable because you're going to get your cable TV. And let's remember, 85% of the country get their television through pay television now. 75% get it through cable, 10% get it through DBS. We have to be on that wire. Now, they are greedy because they control the last mile. They want to impose all these terms and conditions. They don't want open access. We have to expose them, make their life miserable, show there can be alternatives that are affordable and meaningful for competition and for democracy.
I just got Roadrunner in Woodstock, New York.
Oh, you do? Yes.
And just a couple of weeks ago.
They're watching everything you do, you know.
But they, we were having a lot of trouble with our ISP is Prodigy.
Yeah.
And we kept calling them, and it kept, you know, giving us a lot of trouble. And they said, well, you have to change your ISP to AOL.
Yeah.
And it'll work much better.
Sure. Sure. Look, it's not that you won't be able to, well, I'll tell you. It's not that you won't be able to go to every website. It's that they will degrade the quality of service for all the competitors. Now, there's already been one threat, which I'll talk to you about, because it shows you where they're at. Charter Cable, Paul Allen, local. Well, it's great to be able to plug him locally here. Paul Allen, you know, Mr. Wired World. I mean, his wires, I said, is a prison camp, digital prison camp. He's a pretty smart guy. He now owns the number five cable company, right? In 2 years, he went from nothing. So Disney and Fox want to offer movies online, movies.com. What does Charter say to Disney? If you try to offer movies online, you know, in my area, Charter, fifth or sixth largest cable company, I am going to disengage any Charter customer who gets broadband internet from us will not be able to access your website. We're going to de-link you. They just threatened that a few weeks ago, and that was enough basically to get Fox. I mean, who cares about it? But it just shows you they will go to that extreme. So we have to be. So that's why we need to articulate a community civic architecture. That's what we need to do. Our architecture, take the big guys can be out there, but everybody else has an equal opportunity to be out there. It's non-discriminatory. It's abundant. It serves all needs. We don't have to live with the architecture that the cable guys want to give us, which ultimately bandwidth starves the kind of community applications, let alone the alternative commercial applications that we want to see. A community architecture that's democratic and diverse. That's what we're missing here, and that's what I'm hoping that folks are thinking about, and the folks at DIAC. Look, and I want to end, I appreciate your time with this. We can't win in Washington. They're all working for the industry. It's a revolving door, okay? Our side has no money, let alone, right? We're not going to get any money anytime soon, right? More and more of the foundations just don't want to do it. Digital rights management, by the way, the fact that they're trying to privatize the entire system and blah, 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 it's also a part of this whole thing. They're all interrelated. But we need community folks. We need to have a campaign back outside of Washington. So all of a sudden, members of Congress and city council people start hearing, this is an issue. What's happening to my internet? What's happening to open access? What's happening? You know, what will broadband look like? What are the terms and conditions? Why are we letting this company make the decisions, the private architectural decisions for this network? Here are 20 experts, and my God, you have them, half the population here is probably an expert. Here's what we can do. Challenge them. Fight them.
Several of us here tonight are currently organizing a week-long media democracy event in Seattle in September.
Great.
While the National Association of Broadcasters.
The radio conference, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're hoping to be a stepping stone to this larger national campaign.
Actually, there's only 3 people coming, and they all work for Clear Channel.
Yeah.
With a blackout on these issues, basically, in the media.
Yeah.
Media, and it being a non-issue for politicians, as you're saying.
Yeah.
What are you seeing as some of the better opportunities for raising these issues at a broad public level?
I think you could issue a mini report that really looked at what's happened with radio and the fact that there are no local DJs anymore, et cetera, and there's no local news, and God forbid there was ever an earthquake, there's nobody in that place to tell people to get, you know. I mean, I think you can criticize them and focus and show what's at stake and that it's emblematic. It's a litmus test of what we're about to get. But I'm happy to talk with you about I think you should make a lot of trouble here. At the radio conference, even though I personally believe broadband is where the fight should be. Because with all due respect, here's what I think. We lost radio, we lost broadcasting, we lost cable. All right? We lost. We tried. We lost. Where's it going? Okay, they haven't figured it out how to control it all yet. They're working on it. They haven't figured out the business models yet. It's a different system, and we have something that we've never had before in the mass media organizing movement. We have a medium that really evolved as a truly sort of democratic open medium. Now that medium is being purposely integrated into the commercial mass media. But we can say, wait a second, the Supreme Court said in the CDA case, this was the most participatory democratic medium ever created. What are you guys doing with it? Don't you see the inconsistency?
No, I was just going to respond to what Susan said. I think there's a great segue between all of the I work with youth, I teach, and between all of the youth who turned to the internet because the radio is being sold out and the broadband campaign. And I urge you to do something around that in September. Admittedly, do something around that, but try and figure out a way to create a demand that moves into saying, look, we lost on radio, it's trash, it's junk. We all went to the internet to find some new stuff. Now you're trying to take that away from us as well. There's a constituency there. Look at all the millions of people that go to the internet because they give up on radio. I think that's a generational segue.
I agree with you about the youth, and with the broadcasters, you know, I think it's a good point. Just one thought, you could immediately talk about the digital giveaway. So, you know, go away from radio. They lobbied Congress in 96 deliberately to get this digital spectrum so they would be given this preferential placement within a broadband. Nobody else will, right? I mean, so there's a way of criticizing what the broadcasters are doing on the TV side that might be useful. Yeah.
What leverage or power would a progressive city council have to try to jam this up in some way? Mike has some thoughts too, but yeah. We've got a city council that I in Seattle that I think would be open to listening to a lot of this, and several of them who would actually, I think, go on the offensive. And so beyond just posturing, what are some meaningful things that we could ask them to do?
And your city council did pass this, I believe it was city council, the privacy stuff, which was terrific. First place, I think there needs to be a moral voice. I think that they have the court of sort of public pressure. That's going to force Comcast to sort of reposition. The cable industry has been able to erode the power that cities have had over the years to regulate local services, but as far as I know, cities still are allowed to set the terms for to ensure meaningful consumer protection. So under the consumer protection policy framework that local franchising authorities have, they could examine the architecture to look at the upload and download capacity, et cetera. See, they're not allowed to define the architecture, but there's a backdoor way of doing it, and your cable franchise people know it. The problem is that they need the political support, I think, to do something. So there is a leverage here, and particularly if you can expose the architectural plants, I think that's something that could generate a lot of press when you find out that they're not building a robust network for you, that there's going to be limits. You know, cable is purposely engaged in a process of quote unquote bandwidth starving. That's what somebody who's an economic analyst told me. Bandwidth starving their broadband environment because they don't want to allow a lot of competition. So they've deployed this broadband, but what are they doing first? This thing called video on demand, which is a lot of movies. They're purposely limiting the amount and the capacity in order to ensure that they get all the revenues and that competitor broadband content landscape doesn't emerge. I think they can be challenged on that. But we would certainly, my colleagues, we would work with you on that. Last one, thanks.
What do you make of the prospects for condominium fiber as something that a city or a local authority can develop?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to your question. That's really what should be happening here. There should be this kind of municipal plan, laying out of abundant fiber. They should be requiring, maybe they do it here, that whenever the cable company, many cities do this. I don't know if Seattle's doing it. Whenever the cable company digs, some cities basically say, we have to lay our dark, what they call dark fiber in. All right? Yes, to the extent that there is a plan to create a meaningful alternative infrastructure and there's full interconnection, which there should be, that's the way to do it.
That was Jeff Chester, director of the Center for Digital Democracy based in Washington, D.C. He spoke in Seattle a few weeks ago. For more information or to get involved, visit their website at www.democraticmedia.org. We'll conclude the program with a talk by broadcast journalist Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's daily series Democracy Now!, which we're lucky enough to be able to hear here in the Finger Lakes weekdays at 9 a.m. Amy spoke as part of a teach-in held in conjunction with the protests against the World Economic Forum meeting in New York City in January. As you listen, consider what American public opinion might be if the stations that play Rush Limbaugh played Democracy Now!, if political discussions among the citizenry were of the facts and ideas presented by, for example, Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill. It's not a question of bias. Limbaugh's program is no less an expression of his point of view and arguably is less fact-based. It's a question, ultimately, about what ideas and analyses are allowed to reach us, or rather are pushed at us, while others are suppressed or marginalized by scarce outlets.
The great privilege today to speak to you. How does the New York Daily News describe people like you? Legions of agitators, crazies, parasites, and kooks. But it gets a little more serious. The Daily News compared critics of the World Economic Forum to the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center, saying New York will not be terrorized. And the New York Times columnist Clyde Haberman described globalization activists as people, quote, less known for their deep thinking than for their willingness to trash cities, saying some would say that New York needs this protest about as much as it needs another airplane attack. This is a quote chosen by FAIR, a very important organization, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, as it depicts New York City newspapers smearing activists ahead of the World Economic Forum protests. This is extremely serious because it provides the justification, the foundation for serious police brutality, because anything seems to be justified in the face of terroristic attacks, in the face of attacks that might kill people. But who is it that is responsible for deaths around the world? As a new report that was just released today points out, a new report from the world, from the Public Citizen, called Davos World Economic Forum, Pricey Corporate Trade Association Loses Its Camouflage. They talk about who is here and the advantages that they gain, those who attend the World Economic Forum. A quote from CNN Financial News: "The World Economic Forum provides an unmatched opportunity for the world's most powerful people to bump into each other in the Congress's narrow hallways and then adjourn quietly to a back room to talk business. So you have many world political leaders who are here hobnobbing with the global corporate elite to determine the global economic agenda, which goes beyond finances, which goes to shoring up corporations, many of which have larger budgets than the world's nations. If you look at the 100 largest budgets in the world, more than half of them are not countries. They are global corporations. And what are these corporations involved with? A few years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, where in the last few days, thousands have died as a result of a munitions dump blowing up. But it is very important to look at militarism in Nigeria and around the world and who has supported the regimes that have built up the forces that are so dangerous to their own people. A few years ago, I went there with Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill, and we were looking at just one oil corporation and its behavior in a place that the world's media, some of the most powerful corporations in the world, doesn't bother to look. We were looking at Chevron, which has the largest corporation based in California. Chevron, which in the spring of 1998 flew in Nigeria's notorious Navy and mobile police, known as the Kill and Go, to a community in the Niger Delta, just another community that was protesting an oil giant's despoilation, destruction of the environment, asking for some kind of reparations and cleanup. They went to a Chevron barge asking to meet with the Chevron representative, the top one, the American, who was, they knew, would be responsible, who, if he had to respond, that they could be sure something would be done. They saw the Chevron helicopters flying in, thinking that they were bringing in the negotiators, but instead they flew in the mobile police, the Kill and Go, and they landed on the barge. They opened fire on the protesters, killing two, wounding another, rounding up those that were left, putting them in Nigeria's notorious jails where some of them were tortured. This is corporate behavior. This, like those killed at the World Trade Center, those innocent people who lost their lives, is very straightforward. It's terrorism. It's terrorism in Chile in 1973, when AT&T, working with President Richard Nixon and the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, it's terrorism when they, working together, overthrew a democratically elected regime, and in the ensuing years, thousands of innocent Chileans were killed. It's terrorism in Guatemala when for more than 40 years, the successive Guatemalan militaries, backed to the hilt by the U.S. government, killed more than 150,000 innocent Guatemalan citizens. Yes, it's terrorism in Vietnam when 2 million Vietnamese were killed. Henry Kissinger being one of those responsible for that murderous war. These are the killing of innocent civilians, like those killed at the World Trade Center. And those responsible for these massive deaths must be brought to justice, must be tried in international fora like the International Criminal Court, which has been fought covertly and overtly by the U.S. Pentagon and by the U.S. government. Why? They expressly say they're concerned that U.S. officials will be brought before those courts and tried. They don't want U.S. soldiers or officials brought and judged by an international court. Yes, someone like Osama bin Laden and his allies should be brought before that court, but we have to have a universal standard of justice, and people like Henry Kissinger must be tried as well. Now, these are the kinds of issues that should be raised on a regular basis if we had a fair media, an objective media that weighed lives equally. And that is why it is so important to support the independent media. The last time I was here in this building was just after the U.S. began bombing Afghanistan. At that time, me and many of my colleagues had been taken off the air at WBAI. But it is because of people like you around the country, pro-media democracy activists, tens of thousands of people who fought for the last few years, who fought a corporate takeover of the only independent media network in this country, and that is Pacifica Radio. And we have regained our network, and the banned and the fired have been returned to the airwaves. We do experience great victories when people are persistent, and I think that that victory, though we have a long way to go in democratizing our network, but that victory will inspire many different movements in a time of great repression when people feel like they're losing so much ground. It is absolutely critical that we celebrate the moments when we can take back the public space. Pacifica Radio, founded more than 50 years ago by a man named Lou Hill in Berkeley, California, who had refused to fight in World War II and came out of the detention camps along with 40,000 others who refused to fight then, and said there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that beat the drums for war because they profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was founded, with the first station, KPFA. It's why people like Paul Robeson, when banned from the airwaves all over this country and only welcome in a few black churches, knew that he could go to KPFA, the first Pacifica station, and be heard and be broadcast. He knew that there was a safe space there. And it is that safe space that grew to five stations around the country, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington, and KPFT in Houston. KPFT going on the air in 1970, the transmitter blown up twice by the Ku Klux Klan in the first year of operation. And when the Exalted Cyclops went on trial, he said it was his proudest act, because he understood how dangerous Pacifica was, because it opened the airwaves, not, I think, to the minority, but to the majority of voices that are excluded from the mainstream media that continues to beat the drums for war. I think it's no accident that one of the first protests in New York after the bombing of Afghanistan, people marched from Union Square, which had almost become a peace and democracy park until Giuliani had it cleaned up, but where people marched from Union Square to Times Square, yes, named for the New York Times, which is there now, but also the site of the Armed Forces recruiting station. Sometimes it's hard to tell the two apart. The way the media recruits for war. It is absolutely critical we support independent media and that we challenge the mainstream media, especially the corporate networks that are using our airwaves. They are the public airwaves. They are just leasing them. They're supposed to be used for the public good, not to sell military hardware like we saw in the Persian Gulf War, Westinghouse owning CBS and General Electric owning NBC, makers of most of the parts in the of military weapons in the Persian Gulf War. It's no accident that we watched a military hardware show then, as we did in the bombing of Yugoslavia, as we did and continue to do in the bombing of Afghanistan. The Pentagon understands well what bothers people, and I believe what bothers the majority of people. And that is looking at civilian casualties. And that is why it bought up the Iconos satellite imagery, the satellite imagery of the destruction on the ground that could hone in on license plates and certainly show us what civilian casualties look like. They wanted to ensure, if they got the exclusive rights, that while the war was being waged, or I should say the bombing campaign was going on, that we would not be subjected to those images that would turn a population against a military that was committing those crimes against humanity. Yes, what happened on September 11th was certainly terrorism, 3,000 people in New York alone being killed. But more than that have now been killed in Afghanistan. What happened on September 11th, the killing of people like Abe Zalmanowicz, for example, on the 27th floor, whose sister Rita Lazar condemned the loss, the deep tragic loss of her brother, who stayed behind to be with his friend Ed, who is a paraplegic, and said he'd stay with him even though he easily could have gotten out until he got help and he went down with so many others. But Rita said and wrote a piece to the New York Times, a letter, "Not in my name, not in my brother's name." As Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez said in a letter that didn't get published but circulated around the internet, their son, Greg Ernesto Rodriguez, who worked at Cantor Fitzgerald, they said, "Not in our son's name. Don't cause innocent Afghan fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers to grieve like we are. That will not in any way alleviate our pain." And Rita Lazar felt so strongly about this that she went to Afghanistan to bridge the sorrow with those who, like her, were the victims of a terrorist attack. She went with the human rights group Global Exchange, with others who also lost their loved ones, like Kelly Campbell. Her brother-in-law, Craig Amundsen, died in the attack on the Pentagon on September 11th. And she went with Rita and Medea Benjamin, and they traveled around Kabul, and they met a little boy who was 6 years old but seemed like an infant. Why? He was a healthy kid until the U.S. bombing campaign began and the house next door to his was bombed. He didn't seem like he'd suffered physically, but he regressed and was just a drooling baby who could no longer speak and had to be carried around, or the 10 and 11-year-old brother and sister who no longer speak because their neighbor's house was bombed, and they go into spasm. She met those little kids, and she thought about her brother-in-law's little children here in the United States and their loss, and thought, how is it that we think in this country that it is acceptable to avenge the deaths of innocent people by killing innocent people? The polls all show, at least what's expressed on television, that more than 90% of Americans want to bomb Afghanistan. I don't believe that for a minute. I think it is critical we ask, what is the question that was asked? If people were asked, do you think the loss of innocent life should be avenged by the killing of more people, I don't think 90% of people would say yes. In fact, it would probably be completely reversed. 90% of people would say no. And so the way that the corporate media allows this to take place and beats the drums for war is to simply keep information from us, not let us see the civilian casualties, or as Walter Isaacson, head of CNN, instructed the journalists to say, the faces on TV that you see, to say, if by chance they saw civilian casualties, images were portrayed on CNN, to say, don't forget the terrorists who killed the World Trade Center, who killed people at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. Now, how is this connected to what's happening this weekend? How is this connected to the images we're seeing on television? Well, the media has done it for us. They show us the police actions preparing for this weekend to make people afraid to go out and express their dissent. I was talking to a Columbia grad student who was saying particularly foreign students are afraid to go out as we see repressive laws, increasingly the INS working with the police, afraid that they could be picked up and face more than a couple of days in jail. But we see how the police are preparing, and when you equate dissenters with terrorists, anything can happen to you. And so sane people are afraid to go out in the streets, or parents say to their children, please don't do that, don't make us afraid. And so it's the very brave people who go out and say, we understand that the kind of policies that are being discussed and pushed forward and promulgated at organizations like the World Economic Forum, of 3,000 of the world's top corporate leaders hobnobbing with politicians and global leaders, that this is dangerous. When you don't have citizen activists around the world representing civil society right in there saying there is another kind of development and globalization that will stop the vicious cycle of hatred and recrimination that leads to more attacks that we saw on our soil. It is absolutely critical that people be seen on the streets and that the media come into places like this. Yes, I see cameras, but I don't see the networks here, as I didn't see in Seattle in the first days before people went out on the streets, when an unprecedented thousands of people packed the Symphony Hall to hear people speak and discuss ideas about grassroots globalization. No, the media wasn't there showing that give and take, that dialogue, but instead they focused on the shattered glass. Instead they focused on people responding to the attacks by police. That's what was violent on that day. And that, I believe, is the response we're going to see increasingly around the world, like we saw in Genoa with the killing of an activist. When you have the kind of global uprising against corporate power that we have seen in the last few years, it will be met by increasing repression, but it only shows how successful and threatening peaceful nonviolence is. It is absolutely critical that people stand up now more than ever. People challenge the media to tell the truth and stop reflecting the views of a minority elite, and we're not talking about people of color. That people stand up against the consensus that's hailed in Congress between the Democrats and the Republicans, who all are benefiting from corporations like Enron. It's tough to find a congressman or senator that didn't have his palms greased or his pockets lined by that corrupt corporation. We have to break the cycle of violence and decide what we want to be. Do we want to be from the country on earth, the number one superpower whose power is determined by the weapons it sells to repressive regimes? Do we want to be the sword? Or do we want to be, do we want to represent to people around the world and to people here at home, the shield? We have to make the decision, each one of us, the sword or the shield. Thank you.
That was Amy Goodman speaking in January in New York City as part of the protests surrounding the meeting of the World Economic Forum.
If If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take your money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. The men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will come down like an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
PUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Authoritarian Absurdity of the U.S. Constitution, Part 2 of 2, Paul Street on Why It Matters Today. In late March 2019, an extraordinary analysis of the history of the U.S. Constitution arrived from Chicago via radio station WZRD. The talk by Paul Street was so well researched and irreverent and timely that I already produced the first 25 minutes for TUC Radio, and here now is the conclusion. Paul Street is an independent, radical democratic policy researcher, teacher, journalist, historian, and author of 7 books. He spoke at the Open University of the Left in Chicago. He's addressing the question so many are now asking out loud. What is the current status of American democracy that allows the Trump administration to have come to power? And why are many of their policy decisions so difficult to challenge? In part one of this talk, Paul Street began by setting up arguments and proof that the U.S. Constitution is not the sacred document protecting the people's rights, but on the contrary, is authoritarian and anti-democratic by design. He started his talk about the Constitution by defining how he sees the current conditions. Paul Street.
We do live in an insane historical moment, if you don't mind me saying so. Inequality so extreme now that 3 absurdly rich people possess as much wealth between them as the bottom half of the population in the U.S. Economic power so concentrated that you can count on one hand the multi-trillion-dollar financial institutions that control the nation's economic and political assets. 6 corporations together own more than half U.S. print electronic media. 3 internet giants, Google, Facebook, Amazon, rule online communications and shopping. The presidency held by a malignant, narcissist, creeping fascist, pseudo-billionaire most of the nation hates. He pretends to be a populist while doing everything he can to distribute wealth, power further upward.
That was the introduction to Paul Street's Open University Talk, given in Chicago on March 23, 2019. He then began to systematically analyze the different institutions and procedures embedded by the Founding Fathers in the U.S. Constitution that today prevent oversight, control, and correction of course by the people. In the first part of this talk, Paul Street called out the system of rigidly fixed, steeply time-staggered elections that are limiting the possibility of laboring people influencing policy. 2 years for the House, 6 years for the Senate, 4 years for the presidency prevents sweeping changes and all at once popular electoral rebellions. Also, the Founding Fathers created a Supreme Court appointed for life by the President and confirmed by the Senate that is patterned after the British House of Lords. And Paul Street reported how astounded people in other democratic countries are at the curious U.S. system of the Electoral College that guarantees that the popular majority would not directly select the U.S. president. And in the U.S., Street says, we're down to just 15 states who actually have a presidential election, because with winner takes all in blue or red states, all the electoral votes are going to that color. That's a recap of part one. And here is historian and author Paul Street picking up from part one of his talk on the authoritarian absurdity of the U.S. Constitution and why it matters today. Paul Street.
And the Electoral College system just gives us absurdly outsized weight to disproportionately white and right-leaning rural states. And of course, it just openly violates the core democratic principles of majority rule and one person, one vote. Now, when I agreed a while back to come back and do this topic on this date, I thought, well, that'll be fun because I want to talk about this, but it's going to be, I like to work off the news cycle. It's going to be completely off the news cycle, you know? And then actually, this last couple of weeks, the Democratic presidential candidates have started bitching about the Electoral College, interestingly enough. And so it's not completely outside of the news cycle. And it's been fascinating to watch cable news and see right-wing Republican experts come up, because that's what you do on cable news. You get the Democrat over here and the Republican over there, and that's the whole spectrum, the right and the left. And to actually see the right-wing Republican guys actually get up there and just say flat out, we're not a democracy, and the founders didn't want us to be, and we shouldn't be. And the funny thing about it is that the line from Trump and the Republicans is that thanks to the Electoral College, there's an election in the whole country. That's what they say. They go, the small states would be completely, you know, ignored, and we'd only focus on the big cities. And it's just complete nonsense. It's the exact opposite. They're saying 2 + 2 = 5 there. Because of the Electoral College and its winner-take-all electoral system and the partisan geographic polarization of the states now, where you can just write them off, we actually have a presidential election in 15 states at most. The Senate, I love the Senate apportionment system. It's even more skewed to the right. And I'm talking about this, every state gets 2 senators no matter what population they have. It's just Monty Python-esque. It's darkly humorous. The 2% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 smallest states have the same amount of senatorial representation as the 51% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 largest states. Red Wyoming, I love this, home to 573,720 people, holds U.S. senatorial parity with Blue California, where more than 39 American millions reside. That's 1 senator for every 19.5 million Californians versus 1 senator for every 278,000 Wyomingians. What's a Wyomingian? I don't know. Let's say a Wyoming resident. A Wyomingian. Talk about a rotten borough system. You know, you still have rotten boroughs in the British House of Lords. Speaking of boroughs, Just one of New York City's five boroughs, Brooklyn, slated to be home of the Left Forum this year, has 2.6 million people. If Brooklyn, one of New York City's five boroughs, were a state and U.S. senators were apportioned there at the same population-to-senator ratio as Wyoming, Brooklyn would have 9 U.S. senators. And I'm thinking in Brooklyn, it's unlikely that a single one of them would be a Republican. Now, the same goes for Chicago, which is home to 2.7 million people. You know, Brooklyn and Chicago are like the same size. The Chicago metropolitan area is 9.5 million people. If it enjoyed Wyoming's population-to-senator ratio, Chicagoland would have 17 U.S. senators. I mean, think about that. That'd be like one person, one vote, right? Which is like one of the core elementary baseline definitions of democracy is one person, one vote. I'll get even crazier here. The following 13 states have a combined population of 34.4 million. Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and good old Wyoming. Together, these 13 red states send 26 Republicans to the U.S. Senate. Now, granted, those numbers are before the last midterm elections. I did crunch those numbers before that. There might be I might be one off. I doubt it, though. The single state of California with a population more than 5 million higher than those 13 states combined, of course, sends two Democratic senators to our House of Lords, the U.S. Senate. This apportionment system means that the Republican Senate majority answers to a very disproportionately white, rural, and reactionary section of the electorate, and due to a population shift from the agricultural interior to crowded corridors along the coast, it is now at least mathematically possible to cobble together a Senate majority with states that account for just 17.6% of the popular vote. I mean, that's just insane from a Democratic perspective. It's not insane from a right-wing oligarchic perspective. And, you know, don't think that Donald Trump isn't getting a significant part of his agenda through. Not all of it. You know, everything's been Russia now for so long that we forget about all the other shit that's going on. And the handing over of the federal bench and the staffing of the federal judiciary, not to mention the Supreme Court, by the right-wing Federalist Society is a legacy that's going to be with us for a very long time. And who is in charge of passing judgment on Supreme Court appointments? Just the U.S. Senate, not the House. And that U.S. Senate is absurdly overrepresentative of the red state, white nationalist, Republican rural heartland. Now, in some nations operating with parliamentary systems, terrible, awful, disgusting, revolting, narcissistic, dysfunctional, proto-fascistic presidents or prime ministers can be compelled by votes of no confidence and the like to call or accede to new national elections. Wouldn't that be something? A vote of no confidence. We have no confidence in this malignant fascist creep. That's half new elections, right? Such an action is unthinkable in the United States. The Holy Founders, the Holy Constitution, says that qualified voters get to select presidents, well, indirectly, we don't even directly elect presidents, once every 4 years. We can select U.S. senators once every 6 years, and House representatives once every 2 years, and that's the way it is, and if you don't like it, sit down and shut up. Simon says, I once realized that I might be living in an authoritarian society when I was about 5 years old and I first played the game, Simon says, right? It's the stupidest game ever invented. Yeah. A kid says, step over the line, and you step over the line and go, no, you shouldn't have done that. I'm supposed to say Simon says first. Oh, okay. Simon says, put your finger in your nose. Oh, good, very good, you did it. I mean, what is that? You know, that's kind of how we are with the Constitution. I remember once I was sitting in a coffee shop in Iowa City and two University of Iowa law students were looking up for their law books and they had just read some Supreme Court decision. And the one looked at the other and said, you know, we've made like gods out of these guys wearing powdered wigs in the late 18th century, you know, when the Bourbons sat atop France. They're like holy lords or something like that. It's Simon Says.
As George W. Bush's White House spokesperson Dana Perino explained in March of 2008, when a journalist asked her if the citizenry should have input on U.S. foreign policy, you know, like every day, like between elections. Dana Perino said, well, you had your input. The American people have input every 4 years, and that's the way our system is set up. Cheney said something like that, too, you know?
I'm not driven by polls. I don't care what people think. We were elected.
Well, but Perino and Cheney were on strong constitutional ground. Pathetically enough, constitutional Simon says you get to select a president indirectly in a voting booth for 2 minutes or so once every 1,400 days. Well, except you don't actually vote for the president. The Electoral College does, and it's already a done deal in all but 12 to 15 of the states before you walk in the voting booth, but you get the idea. You get to vote for a U.S. House member. Usually, by the way, and I didn't have time to go into gerrymandering, which isn't in the Constitution. There's nothing that mandates gerrymandering in the U.S. Constitution. But you get to vote for a U.S. House member, usually in a heavily gerrymandered district, for a few minutes once every 730 days. You get to vote for each of your U.S. senators once every 1,095 days. You don't vote for Supreme Court justices. The president, for whom you don't vote directly, appoints them, subject to approval from the Senate, which absurdly overrepresents the rural and white populace. That's how you get a serial abuser like Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court for life. Supremes are appointed for life, which is like a really, really long time. Well, it can be. It's why we're so desperate to, you know, everything, to people, liberals, and, I mean, even me, to anything. If we just keep Ruth Bader Ginsburg alive long enough to not have a fascist president to replace her. Now, it's true that malignant presidents like Trump can be constitutionally impeached by the House and removed by the Senate, but the barriers to removal are very steep, and again, that's on purpose. It's never happened, though Richard Nixon would certainly have been impeached and removed had he not resigned. He resigned after the moment when Senator Barry Goldwater went in and told him, we've got the votes in the Senate. So, I mean, you know, in effect, Nixon was a de facto impeachment and removal. But the barriers are very, very steep. It's never actually happened except kind of for Nixon. Full defenestration of a president, no matter how awful that president are, requires a two-thirds vote in the absurdly unrepresentative Senate. And, of course, the Senate right now is under the Republicans. But what would impeachment and removal give us under the revered, holy U.S. Constitution anyway? The presidency of the arch-right-wing Republican Mike Pence. You think Trump is scary? Pence is a Christian white nationalist fascist under whose rule the hard right agenda that most of the populace hates might be advanced more effectively than it is under Trump. Don't like it? Too bad. Simon, I mean, the Constitution says that's how it is. So, suck it up, Buttercup. Get back in shape for the next strictly time staggered, constitutionally mandated, quadrennial, candidate-centered electoral extravaganza to vote a Democrat into the White House? Really? Why bother? The Democrats are every bit as corporatized and sold out to the financial plutocracy and its military empire, to the capitalist system that emerged out of national development under the rule of the propertied elite that the holy founders worked so hard to protect. Every bit is captive to and sold out to and owned by that system as the Republicans. And they are that way, thanks in part to the outrageously outsized role of big money campaign contributions in the nation's politics, in its ever more absurdly expensive elections. And that role of money, the role of campaign finance, the role of the wealth primary, so to speak, in our electoral process, is traceable at least in part to the U.S. Constitution. The founding finaglers created the Supreme Court as a critical appointed for life, check on the popular will, and in two landmark decisions that took place in the lifetime of everybody in this room, I think. Maybe one, no, everybody, I'm looking around. In the Buckley-Vallejo decision, 1976, and the Citizens United decision of 2010, the High Court has ruled that private campaign contributions are free speech and that there are no constitutional limits that can be set on how much the rich and the powerful can invest in the giant organized bribery project that is U.S. campaign finance. Don't like it. Too bad. Simon, I mean the Supreme Court and the Constitution, says. Want to form a politically relevant, more genuinely progressive and egalitarian third party beyond the radically regressive and reactionary Republicans and the dismal dollar-drenched Democrats? Hope the Founders' Holy Charter is not on your side. It encourages winner-take-all, first-past-the-post elections tied to specific geographical districts. There's no provision in it for proportional representation to accommodate and create room for third or fourth parties that are never ready at the first election that they roll out their agendas to compete and win pluralities in American elections. You don't like it, neither do I, neither do most Americans. Most Americans forever have told pollsters that the two big money major parties do not adequately represent the actual spectrum of political opinion in this country. And again, so what? Who cares? Too bad. Simon says, sit down and shut up. So what is to be done? Everything. Everything is still to be done. You don't have to have a decent constitution in place to engage in class struggle and the fight for the common good. The Bolsheviks didn't need a good constitution. There wasn't any constitution at all to make the Russian Revolution in 1917. Electoral politics, constitutional interventions and congressional investigations and Mueller reports are not the only or even the leading politics that matter or ought to matter most to a real functioning left. Take to the streets, occupy workplaces, idle capital, besiege corporate headquarters, protest corporate media, sabotage pipelines, monkey wrench ecocide, defend immigrants, provide sanctuary, form grassroots movements, learn how to build barricades, put on a yellow vest, become a gilet jaune, stop traffic, transcend sectarianism, form a movement culture that makes movements fun again, engage in civil disobedience, join the Extinction Rebellion, get real about the state of the world, hold workshops on what capitalism and industrialism are doing to livable ecology, form community permacultural gardens, resist the racist police. People are doing this. None of this stops being essential because the nation is absurdly beholden to an absurd parchment from the time when the nation was ruled by slave owners and merchant capitalists wearing powdered wigs. That said, we ought, like the Gilets Jaunes in France, to be calling for a new national government and a new national charter. Around the planet, national constitutions actually do not generally last all that long. As Zachary Elkins, Thomas Ginsburg, and James Melton note in their book, The Endurance of National Constitutions, it sounds like the title of their book actually ought to be The Non-Endurance of National Constitutions, quote, the mean lifespan of constitutions across the world since 1789, French Revolution, is 17 years. Since World War I, the average lifespan of a constitution, they say, is 12 years. And I'm not saying we should be rewriting constitutions every 2 months either. I mean, that can get dysfunctional as well. But the U.S. is just ridiculously different. It's just off the charts the other way. It's absurdly venerated, purposefully democracy-disabling constitution has remained in place with occasional amendments for 230-plus years. We've bowed down and prayed to the fetishized, explicitly, openly anti-democratic U.S. Constitution for way too long.
We deserve something much better, to be drafted by people's representatives elected to a constituent assembly, empowered to write a new national charter that would be dedicated to the introduction and the preservation of our holy founder's ultimate nightmare, popular sovereignty. We can talk about some of what might be included in such a new national charter. Curiously enough, that has actually emerged in the Gilets Jaunes movement. There's an explicit call for a Sixth Republic in France and for a rejection of the fetish of so-called bourgeois representationalism and a call for direct democracy. Imagine that. And isn't it amazing how monumentally invisible the French protests have been in American media? And in fact, when they were peaking in December and November, I swear, this doesn't surprise me actually, I saw more footage from France. This is incredible footage. This is a country that shares a lot of Western civilizational history in the United States. It has a seat on the United Nations Security Council. This is a big deal nation, France. They're a nuclear power, both in terms of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, undergoing a prolonged mass, damn near proto-revolutionary movement in the streets for week after week after week. And it was barely covered on cable news, on CNN and MSNBC. And I saw more of it on Fox, because Fox kind of liked it because they hate Macron, because they paint him out as some sort of leftist, which is, of course, completely absurd. He's a neoliberal in the mode of the Clintons and the Obamas. And it was sparked by a fuel tax. And the Trumpies loved that, because then they wanted to frame the Gilets Jaunes as really being against the environmental agenda, which was shit, because in fact, what the Gilets Jaunes, many of them are environmentalists, what they were objecting to was the regressive nature of the fuel tax was disproportionately imposed on these working class people who have to commute to work at ever increasing distances from French cities because of gentrification in France. And also it was a tax that had come in the wake of the repeal of the famous social wealth tax in France too. In other words, they were saying, why should we have to disproportionately pay for efforts to stem climate change? Turns out they're not anti-climate. They're not against healing the planet. But in any event, not even on the radar screen of our media. I'm trying to remember at the time Gilets Jaunes was going on, what was obsessing national media at the time. Oh, there was the shutdown stuff. Yeah, we were all about the shutdown stuff. And of course, we've been obsessed about Russia. You would think there's just nothing but Russia's alleged oligarchic overthrow of our purported democracy for just about the last 2 years, right? You know, I did a paper on Truthdig, or I think it was Counterpunch somewhere. It's like, who will save our democracy from the oligarchs? The American oligarchs. The American oligarchy. And anyway, I thought I'd throw all that in there. There's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that it's grim. The one thing I like about this Extinction Rebellion group, which has come up, is that they reject, and they do this in an in kind of a spiritual Buddhist existential kind of way. They reject the false dichotomies of hope and fear, this future orientation. We always have to stay hopey, changey, and happy. No, the old left-wing slogan, don't mourn, organize, is bullshit. I don't want to be organized by anybody that doesn't know how to mourn. Properly mourn the situation we're in. Deal with it. And then get real about where we really are. That's where actual action that might matter begins. And the ER slogan is hope dies, action begins. And I actually like that. Because we live in the present moment. And hope and fear, but both take us out of it. The earth is our witness. The real world that we're living in, where livable ecology is now seriously in danger. And human extinction is something we can actually talk about by 2100. Deal with that and then get serious and operate from there.
That was the conclusion of a talk by Paul Street, an independent, radical democratic policy researcher, teacher, journalist, historian, and author of 7 books. Among his books are The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power, and Crashing the Tea Party, mass media, and the campaign to remake American politics. Paul Street's essays and commentaries have appeared in Counterpunch, Truth Dig, Black Agenda Report, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, and CNN, among others. He spoke on March 23, 2019, at the Open University of the Left in Chicago. Credit for the recording of Paul Street goes to Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio in Chicago. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And welcome to the Taylor Report. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Phil Conlon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to be talking to Eva Bartlett, and Eva Bartlett is speaking at 777 Bathurst, April 25th. That's Thursday at 7 p.m., and she's going to be in Hamilton at 24 Main Street, the New Vision United Church, on the 29th of April. That's the 25th and the 29th, 25th at 777 Bathurst, a different book list, 7 p.m. Thursday, and the 29th April, that's a Monday at 7 o'clock, 24 Main Street, West Hamilton. And I think we're joined by Eva Bartlett herself. Are you there, Eva?
Hi, Phil, times two.
It's great to be talking to you, Eva. By the way, I always like to say that you have a great Twitter account. I hope everybody's following it, and you say there, I go to the places I write about, and we live in a world where we have major newspapers who actually don't have correspondents in the places that they are causing problems for. Of course, now you've been most recently to Venezuela. I guess the first question, is it getting more difficult to get to Venezuela? The U.S. is becoming very nasty, and we hear rumors about their, you know, the airlines being less cooperative and such things.
Yeah, actually, I had been in Venezuela before in 2010, and so I was there for about 6 months, so I had some experience in the country, and I didn't anticipate the difficulty of getting there when I went in March, and so basically I did what I usually do and shop around on the airline, you know, Expedia-type sites for a bargain flight, and so I found one with three connections on American Airlines, so it was Toronto via New York via Miami. And there was an overnight in Miami. That's fine. You know, it's a cheap flight. But the next morning, it was due to fly around 7 a.m., and they the airline twice delayed, and I kept asking them, what's up with this? What's the reason for the delay? Initially, they said, oh, well, there's not enough electricity at the airport in Caracas for us to land. And so I contacted a friend I know who was working there with Press TV, and I said, hey, Ahmed, is this true? And then he talked with Venezuelan journalists. I said, no, there's flights taking off and landing even now, even though there was this sabotage, this electricity crisis. Mm-hmm. In the end, American canceled my flight, leaving me no option really but to find a new flight on my own. So I did fly via Panama on Copa Airlines, and I asked the airline, have you been flying to Venezuela in recent days? And they said yes. So yeah, it was very difficult to get there, and it wasn't only my flight, but another a couple of people I knew that were coming to Venezuela the next day on American also had the same thing happen. And although I had initially planned to spend just a week this time in Venezuela, mm-hmm. come a week later, American had canceled for the indefinite future all flights to Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. I was very impressed. Of course, when you were going there, the big story, and the one actually I read it in the Toronto Star, so it must be so. They were reviewing some sort of theater production here, and the reviewer said, Venezuela, the performers from Caracas, which is experiencing widespread starvation. Mm. Thank heavens, Eva Bartlett went down and looked around. Tell us about that story. I mean, you covered it, by the way. People can find that at just Eva K. Bartlett Twitter. I know that was probably the first thing on your mind to kind of get around and see what the reality was.
Yes, in tandem with the starvation claim has been the claim since many months prior, when all this war propaganda and rhetoric started escalating. The claim that there's no food in supermarkets and stores, right? These are the main themes going around, and that basically the country is in a state of chaos. And so when I went there, when I finally did arrive, I arrived on, I think it was March 10th, and so I walked around streets that I was familiar with in downtown Caracas, and honestly, Phil, it seemed like 2010. The streets were emptier because the power was out. So the metro wasn't running. The metro serves something like 3 million people daily. And by the way, it's free of cost. But other than that, there were some shops open, including restaurants with food. And as the days passed, I tried to document by photo and video that, yes, there was food being sold. In fact, I went to the poorest district, and there's an area called Petare. It's known as the largest slum in Latin America. And I went there with a friend on his motorcycle, and we drove all around, and even in the hilltop barrios, Cinco de Julio, the 5th of July barrio, for example, you saw shops selling chicken, you saw stands selling fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. So wherever I went, I didn't see a lack of food, and I did see starvation. I'm sure there are people living in poverty. That's undeniable. Mm-hmm. But what the Western media is doing is constructing this idea that there's just widespread chaos. Yeah. Without mentioning the reasons why there are poverty, and of course, top amongst those reasons is the economic war the U.S. has been waging, and Canada, against Venezuela for years, and the sanctions that keep increasing against mm-hmm. Venezuela. But certainly there is food in the supermarkets, and additionally, the government has taken initiatives, various initiatives. I think it was, I don't want to say the year, but some years ago they started an initiative whose acronym is CLAP. It's the Spanish version has something to do with food program. And basically, I believe it's on a monthly basis, although they do intend to increase it to biweekly. Food boxes are sent out to 6 million families in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And they're so inexpensive, they're almost free, and they contain proteins and produce and cooking oil, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Certainly better than, by the way, the humanitarian assistance that I saw in Gaza. And then in addition to that, the government also has more recently an urban agriculture initiative. So they're doing rooftop gardening, they're doing community gardening, small space gardening, and they're trying to encourage civilians to be as independent as they can. Now, what's funny is this morning I was looking, I just Googled it just to see what had been reported on. I don't remember the source. I think one was NPR, the other might have been the Washington Post, both from a couple of years ago. And they were deriding this initiative of urban agriculture, implying, you know, well, you can imagine the kind of implications they were saying, mm-hmm. like the government's unable to provide for its people, so it's demanding they grow their own food. But I met another community, Ciudad Marish, I think it was called, and it's a hilltop community, very poor, but they have taken a lot of initiatives. They do flat boxes, and they're also doing local gardening. And they were saying, like, you know, we're not starving. Every person I asked was saying, we're not starving, we are poor, and then they would give the reasons why. And Venezuelans, by and large, are very informed of the geopolitical reasons for their mm-hmm. poverty and what the U.S. has been doing to their country.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to Eva Bartlett, Eva's going to be at a different book list on Thursday, the 25th at 7 o'clock, 777 Bathurst. What about this power outage? You say that you experienced some of it yourself. What is it? How is it being handled? What's your impression of what's going to be unfolding with the power issue?
Yeah, so the power first went out, I think it was March 7th, and it was out for 5 or 6 days. And I arrived on the 10th, so a few days into it. And the airport was functioning enough for planes to land. Even the luggage carousel was running. But the power outage, and I know this very intimately from living in Gaza for several years. In Gaza, if I may, just as an aside, the power was out for 18 to 20 hours a day for years. And now I've seen more recent reports saying, well, now they have power for 8 hours a day. So this is just worth mentioning because all this false concern for the power outage in Venezuela by Marco Rubio, by, you know, Mike Pompeo, by the Western media.
Crocodile tears.
Absolutely, because they could not care less about Palestinians in Gaza, for example, or Yemen. But so the power outage does impact on every aspect of life. But what I noted was, like I said earlier, there was no chaos. Mm-hmm. I saw long lines of people standing, waiting for ATMs when the power came on or around water distribution centers. But you would imagine, perhaps you have some insight into this, in a city like Toronto, for example, if the power was out for more than 2 days, it was out for 5 or 6 days, there probably would be quite a bit of chaos, including looting. But there were reports of looting on Venezuela's border with Colombia. And I talked with various journalists about that, and they said the incident that they had heard about was one of the main companies there, which is opposition-controlled, is called Polar, and they manufacture beer and bread products and probably, I think, soft drinks as well. And the looting that occurred was in a mall in Maracaibo, and it was, according to these journalists I spoke with, that it was soft drinks and beer. So not exactly the critical items you'd be looting if you're starving. But other than that, like over the course, there were two series of power outages, and the Venezuelan government asserts that it was a combination of hacking, sabotage on the system, and they listed Chicago and I want to say somewhere in Texas, maybe Houston, as sources. There was something to do with a component of the system being manufactured in the U.S. and also physical attacks on the system, and then. I stayed because American Airlines canceled my flight. I said, okay, fine, I'm just going to stay for another couple of weeks in Venezuela. So I was staying in a very cheap hotel on the 8th floor. So, you know, the power's out. That meant everything was off. I started collecting water in garbage bins, plastic bins, so that I could wash at least, you know, with that water. But the point was the only chaos I heard was when the lights would go off, and then I'd hear the opposition supporters screaming and howling and banging on pots and pans and blaming Maduro. They might actually believe it, but I've also seen on Twitter and social media that Juan Guaido, the man that the West has chosen to be president, that most Venezuelans I met do not recognize as president, has encouraged people to react this way every time the power goes out. And there was even a clip where he was on a program being interviewed, and he essentially was admitting, you know, involvement, basically saying it would continue until the usurpation of the government, meaning the President Maduro, was over. Mm-hmm. And certainly there are other articles. I think it's Max Blumenthal or the Gray Zone came out with an article detailing, and Mint Press News as well, detailing how the U.S. has the capabilities of hacking into power systems. And, you know, they had
actually, yes, we've had reports from other countries. Iran has had their system hacked, and I know that you probably saw the same item. A former Iranian-American engineer said that he had been offered $250,000 to plant a device that would have knocked out the power for Tehran. And he says, you know, I mean, this is a guy who is on the record. He a credible individual. So. Yeah. And you notice that people like Bolton and Pompeo always smirk when somebody said, "Well, did you have anything to do with it?" They don't really say no. They have that expression on their face saying, "Well, we're going to cause this guy pain." I mean, they Bolton and Pompeo believe in causing pain to people like people in Gaza and then Caracas, if they can do it, they think it will cause people to turn on the government.
And I believe it was Marco Rubio who actually was tweeting in a smirking manner about the power being out the first round, March 7th, before it had even been officially announced in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was a second round of power outages, and this one was attributed to direct physical sabotage on the main power plant, the Guri hydroelectric plant. The government came out with statements. I believe they were saying it was attacked by snipers, which is entirely possible. And so that caused continuous outages. And then as the government worked, and extensive damage as well, as the government worked to repair that damage, there were planned outages in order to give people power, you know, in different areas while the lines were being repaired. Mm-hmm. But one day I was with a local journalist, and we were on, I forget the name of the mountain. It's not Avila. It's another mountain in Caracas. And I had been along that road many times, going to different areas, and I'd seen these massive tankers that were organized by the government to collect clean spring water, drinkable spring water, and deliver them around Caracas. And I saw a whiteboard with a list of, I think it was 20 hospitals and clinics that were being prioritized. Another day, I went with this local journalist along that same road, but we went to a different area where there was more outlets for this spring water, and people were collecting. And apparently, they normally would collect water there, not in the numbers that we were seeing, but because the water was an issue, there were more people that had driven in cars or walked to collect the spring water. But the observations we made were, again, it was extremely calm. There was people were just waiting in line for their turn to collect the water. But also, when we left that spot, just down the road, maybe a kilometer, maybe less, there was a fire raging on the side of the mountain, and I asked the journalist, well, at this time of year, is it normal for fires to start from like a cigarette or something? He said, no, it's not. Most likely it's sabotage, and it was very close to electrical lines, so it could have been more dangerous than it was. We came back there an hour or so later, and the firefighters had put the fire out, and one of the firefighters said he wasn't authorized to speak on behalf of the department, but he said it was definitely sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems like, and unsurprisingly, there's a sustained campaign to create havoc and chaos in the country. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, when I kept asking people and journalists, you know, has there been widespread looting, or, you know, what's the reason that people aren't going nuts? They said, well, you know, they experienced in 2002, I believe it was, well, there was the coup d'etat attempt on Chavez back then, and they've experienced various efforts from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So they're most of them, not speaking of the opposition supporters who can be very violent, the ones that are more politically aware are know that the way to react is calmly. And then, sorry if I can just add on too, there are local groups, organized groups called colectivos. They're incredibly demonized in the media. They literally just mean collectives or organized groups of people, and they can be anything from, you know, an environmental collective, a pensioners collective, feminist collective, a youth collective, whatever. And I spoke with the leader of this one youth collective, and he was saying, for example, in his area, when the power was out, they organized together to get a water tanker to distribute water to people in the community. And they also had one fridge where they were collecting, you know, people's chicken or whatever the protein was. So they were working together to ensure that people at least could all get what they needed to survive.
Mm-hmm. This is Eva Bartlett, Eva K. Bartlett on Twitter. And there's also the account of ingaza.wordpress.com. And Eva's talking, by the way, at Bathurst, 777 Bathurst Street, 7 o'clock, this coming Thursday on the 25th. Eva, did you see demonstrations on your account on the Twitter, I saw you posted some of these rather funny pictures of Mr. Guaido running into a group of women who didn't appreciate his presence and chased him away. I mean, do you hear political talks anywhere? Do you watch them on TV, or what was the political climate like?
Well, I kept trying to go to pro opposition, pro Guaido protests. So on March 16th. I did go to a protest that was pro-Maduro, anti-imperialist, and I'm terrible at estimating. However, my video is on YouTube. It's Eva K. Bartlett also. And it was If I said thousands, it's probably an understatement, the numbers of people that were participating. Mm-hmm. In any case, it was a massive, a very, very long, long, long demonstration. I walked with demonstrations, demonstrators for a couple of hours filming. It was a very vibrant, jubilant kind of mood. People were singing and dancing, but also Venezuelans are very, they're not shy to come up to you and start just without even introduction, spouting uh-huh. their political views. And so I heard a lot of people at the demonstration talking with a very aware, informed political awareness about, mm-hmm. again, the need to defend their country against foreign meddling and mm-hmm. the fact that they did not recognize Guaido. That same day, March 16th, a local journalist had offered to take me on her motorcycle to some of the demonstrations that had been planned, according to various opposition supporters on Twitter, but they never materialized. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, I went to another demonstration on March 30th, again, a massive pro-government demonstration. This time, I actually went with this Colectivo leader on his motorcycle, and we joined hundreds of motorcyclers throughout the city. Now, this is worth mentioning that these types of motorcyclers are also demonized in the media, but these are people that live in the poorest areas, barrios. I saw men and women and sometimes children on the bikes. I didn't see arms. They may or may not have arms, but this is the way they're portrayed in the media, is they're thugs. Uh-huh. And they were literally going through the city and showing their defiance against any sort of intervention against their country. Yeah. That same day, I tried to go to other demonstrations earlier, prior to joining this one. I actually, I'd been told by different journalists that starting 10 a.m., and they sent me these tweets starting 10 a.m. in various areas in eastern Caracas, which is generally known as the opposition stronghold, upper-class areas, but also in some of the central Caracas mixed areas, that there would be demonstrations. So before 10 a.m., I walked out on the street. I hailed down a motorcycle taxi. I asked him to take me to one of these first areas, and then I explained to him where I was trying to go. So he ended up taking me around to many of the points where there were supposed to be people collecting. At one of the points, actually, in El Paraíso, I didn't see any opposition supporters. I saw a group, a large group of pro-Maduro supporters yeah. walking to join this massive demonstration that I saw later in the day. I kept going around with this driver and eventually ended up in Chacao and Altamira, which are eastern Caracas opposition strongholds. Mm-hmm. In Chacao, I saw 10, 15 people walking the sidewalk. In Altamira, I saw a couple dozen. And the crowds never came into fruition. So it's unfortunate because yeah. I did want to see what they had to say.
You tried to cover them. They didn't show up themselves.
Yeah,
You would have given them the time. This is Eva Bartlett. By the way, you are an adventurer. You said motorcycle taxi. And I think, oh, my goodness. Now, you interviewed somebody. I got a kick out of this, and it's very important to identify that you mentioned Max Blumenthal is doing great work, and also VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Mm-hmm. You interviewed Mr. Dobson, was it?
Yes.
And now they've come under attack, too. They've been hacked a bit, but tell us about your estimate of their work.
They've come under attack, I think, for the last week. Their website is down. They've been posting updates on Facebook and Twitter. There are, in my opinion, and I'm, of course, not an expert on Venezuela, but in my opinion, they are one of the best English language sites on Venezuela. Their authors, I believe all or almost all of their authors are based in Venezuela and are Venezuelan, with the exception of some like Paul Dobson. And they provide good analysis. They're independent. I did specifically ask Paul when I interviewed him if they had any sort of government funding, and he said absolutely not, in which case I would encourage people when the website's back up to look at their material, because it provides a very critical voice of what's happening in Venezuela, analyses, interviews, and also examining the propaganda against Venezuela. For example, back in February, a month after Guaido self-proclaimed himself as president, I believe it was exactly a month after that, there was the aid truck stunt at the border with Colombia, mm-hmm. wherein they tried to force what they called aid into Venezuela. The Venezuelan government said there are legitimate means to deliver aid, like Russia, China, Cuba, and other countries have been doing via the Red Cross and other bodies, but we will not accept it to be forced through Colombia. And I, this is an aside, but this friend Ahmed from Press TV, he went to the border when the aid truck incident was happening, and the trucks ended up getting burnt, and corporate media was saying the quote unquote Maduro regime burnt these trucks, when in fact it actually came from people on the Colombian side, Molotov cocktails and so on, causing these trucks to be burnt. But Ahmed said he saw the contents of, I think it was at least one of the trucks, and it contained wires, among other things, and not aid.
Yeah.
But anyway, now I got off on a tangent there. We're talking about Venezuela analysis.
I know what my tangent was.
Yes, because they did a very detailed breakdown of the propaganda around that particular incident.
Yeah.
And they've done really incredible work. So I believe they've come under attack, probably because more people are looking for accurate information on Venezuela.
Yeah. It just underlines how important your work is. It's Eva K. Bartlett on Twitter. And Eva is going to be speaking at 777 Bathurst on April 25th. That's Thursday at 7 o'clock. You're doing great work, Eva, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Phil. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.